You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
This is Guns and Butter. Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear.
There's a man with a gun over there. They have now refined these systems and the way to organize and manage them so that the Phoenix model can be perfectly applied anywhere around the world. And the CIA, it actually has created 10, 15, 20 of these Phoenix-style centers around the world and is now organizing itself in this manner so it can more perfectly coordinate with military forces and the State Department in countries where it's fighting this war on terror.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Douglas Valentine. Today's show, Phoenix as the model for homeland security and the war on terror. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program about the CIA in Vietnam and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology with Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. His latest book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Today we discuss the Phoenix program in Vietnam, how systems analysis was used to implement the program, and how the Phoenix model is still in use today. Douglas Valentine, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Your book, The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, was originally published in 1990, but trashed by a review in the New York Times by Morley Safer, who'd been a reporter in Vietnam. You have written that the book was killed because it said that Phoenix never would have succeeded if the reporters in Vietnam hadn't covered for the CIA. Your book, The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, has now been published online by the Forbidden Bookshelf series. With regard to the war in Vietnam in general, your book paints a very complex picture of the bureaucratic structures of both the civilian and military components and their interfaces with each other. A constantly shifting chain of command, personnel, programs, strategies, tactics. It was impossible for me to track it all. The whole enterprise reads like a god-awful mess, even apart from the incredible violence and carnage of that war, and the Phoenix program in particular. In your book, you mention organizational reforms that paved the way for Phoenix. What were you referring to?
It helps to have a little history. So, you know, to put it in context, like you said, it's a very big subject. And just let me lead up to how it all came to be. It'll only take a minute or two. But as your listeners may know, the United States first intervened in Vietnam in around 1954, 1955, when the country was divided in half. And the great powers of the world were going around dividing up countries all over the world at the time. Korea got divided up. A lot of countries got divided up. And the North went to what were called the Communists under Ho Chi Minh, and the South went to the United States, which installed a puppet president named Diem. Diem was a Catholic, and he did not have widespread support via Vietnam, was 95% Buddhist. So by 1963, it was evident that the Americans could not gain any political, real political support in South Vietnam with Diem as president. So the CIA bumped him off in 1963. They allowed a cabal of South Vietnamese generals to knock off Diem. And they put in a cabal of Buddhist generals, and they thought this would help gain support of the rural population for the American presence in South Vietnam. And they began really waging a counterinsurgency against the rural population. It was very intense. And the CIA was leading that effort to pacify the South Vietnamese population and make them support the South Vietnamese government, which did not represent any of their interests, but that was the struggle that the CIA was facing at the time. And they put a lot of programs in place, which were called pacification programs. They set up a secret interrogation center in each of South Vietnam's 44 provinces. And they created what were called counter-terror teams in every province, which would go off and hunt the supporters of the Viet Cong. And they set up what were called armed propaganda teams, which would go into the villages and try to propagandize people. And they also set up in 1964 a lot of sort of Stalinist tribunals. Some of them were military and some of them were civilian, in which anybody who didn't actively support the South Vietnamese government could be tried on national security charges without any evidence and sent to jail, sent to prison. So they put all these programs, the CIA put all these programs in place. And in 1965, the United States government sent the military in because the war still wasn't going very well. And when the United States military arrived, it was, you know, hundreds of thousands of soldiers were fighting. North Vietnamese troops had now started to infiltrate along the Ho Chi Minh trails, coming into mostly the northern and central parts of South Vietnam. But by 1966, the United States realized it still did not have the support of the South Vietnamese citizenry, which was overwhelmingly supporting what was called the National Liberation Front. The Americans had the support of, you know, the bourgeoisie, which was in the cities, but out in the countryside, they did not have the support of the people. So in late 1966, the White House told the CIA to create what was called a General Staff for Pacification, and they did this secretly. And by the summer of 1967, the CIA had created this General Staff for Pacification, which combined all of the CIA programs that it was conducting in the countryside and in the cities with all the U.S. military programs and all the State Department programs, all the South Vietnamese programs, which were involved in pacification. And that was called the Phoenix Program. The Phoenix Program was based on what you referred to earlier, systems theory, systems analysis. The idea was to coordinate all these many systems which were in place in South Vietnam and which were designed to pacify the South Vietnamese population. And they did this secretly, and they created this secret organization called Phoenix, which had, apart from its mission of coordinating some 25 or 30 different ongoing programs in South Vietnam, but it had the overall purpose of pacifying the South Vietnamese civilians. And that pacifying them meant either coercing or enticing them to support the government. And if they didn't support, off to jail they went, and no trial necessary. And the other part of Phoenix was what was called an attack on the Viet Cong infrastructure. This was the part of the Phoenix that's most known to people, the assassination squads, the torture centers. Through a nationwide network of informants, the CIA ran what was called the Hamlet Informant Program, in which the police established informants in every village, in every district, in every province in South Vietnam that they could. And those informants would inform on any civilian who was in any way sympathetic to the National Liberation Front. Those names, people would be brought into the interrogation centers. They'd be worked over. They'd be made to inform. They'd be made to turn into double agents. And if they didn't, off to the security court they went, or they took them out back and shot them. And once they had the names of the people, and these are civilians, the civilian members who are secretly supporting the National Liberation Front. These are not soldiers. This is a woman who works in the Women's Liberation Unit, or somebody who's a courier, or somebody who's currying rice to Viet Cong guerrilla units. It was all civilians. Once they had identified these people, they would send out the CIA's hit teams, which were called counterterror teams. And the military lent support. The military provided most of the people that worked for the Phoenix program. It was always under CIA direction. And in the early years, it was largely staffed in the provinces by the CIA, but it was always under CIA direction. But once the majority of the people that worked for the Phoenix program were military people who were detailed to the CIA, and there was hundreds and thousands of these people, plus there were thousands and thousands of South Vietnamese secret policemen. There were thousands of these armed propaganda teams, of hit teams. It was just a massive, massive undertaking. It was secret for the first 2 years, but it all relied on very sophisticated theories of it was computerized, highly sophisticated theories of organization and management, which is why when the person who was detailed to create the Phoenix program was a guy I interviewed at length. His name was Nelson Brickell. He was a graduate from Yale. He was considered an organizational genius. And he described at length to me, and it's in the book, how he actually used models from Ford Motor Company and businesses, big corporations, in order to streamline and bureaucratize, which was essentially a system of political repression in South Vietnam. If you don't do what we want, either you get killed or you go to jail. And that's one of the best explanations I can give you about the Phoenix program. Of course, it's much more. It relies very much on corruption, on giving the South Vietnamese policemen an incentive to coerce and to bribe and extort South Vietnamese citizens. And it was done on a massive scale. The whole idea was to give the policemen and the people who were collaborating with the United States a free hand to make money off this program. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done it, just like CIA allowed its generals and its politicians to import and sell heroin and other drugs in South Vietnam. They incentivized this program, and essentially it was they gave the police and the military a free hand to extort the people, and just totally fractures the society as a way of being able to either intimidate or coerce or entice somebody into working for the South Vietnamese government. And of course it didn't work. The people resisted in very heroic ways. And there's a lot of revisionist history about the Vietnam War now, and Phoenix is being touted as something that was actually very successful because it knocked off so many people. The program is estimated between 1967 and 1971 to have killed through it, so the Phoenix assassination team, some 30,000 people. The South Vietnamese put the figure at 40,000. My own estimate is that those are way off, and hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Hundreds of thousands of people were sent to prison through these Stalinist tribunals, which relied totally for evidence on the testimony of an anonymous informant who would just say, you know, well, that guy over there stole something from me, so now I'm going to inform, you know, or his dog pooped on my lawn, so now I'm going to say he's a sympathizer for the Viet Cong, and then off to jail the guy would go. He wouldn't even be able to appear in court to defend himself. It was that horrible of a situation. And nevertheless, a lot of revisionist historians now are sort of overlooking those details and saying it was a very successful program. It has indeed served as the model nowadays for the war on terror and as a model for the Department of Homeland Security in terms of systems theory.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, Phoenix as the model for Homeland Security and the War on Terror. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Was the Phoenix program in effect all through the war up until the end of the Vietnam War, or did they ever end it?
No, it went through a couple of different manifestations, but it never ended. I have seen telegrams in a Freedom of Information Act request as late as 1975 talking about how, you know, the Phoenix program was still in effect. There was a negotiated ceasefire. This is at the end of 1972. And the villages that were actually supporting the National Liberation Front would actually start waving, their flag. And according to CIA officers I talked to, this just made it easier now for them to send their Phoenix teams out there and knock these people off, because now they were no longer secret. They were just advertising themselves. And that's one of the reasons that the ceasefire failed, just like all these ceasefires that the United States is negotiating in Syria or wherever always seem to fail because, like all the treaties that negotiates, it never abides by them. And the greatest method for not abiding by any of these treaties is that the CIA is always behind the scenes operating in secret and trying to undermine them. And all the press corps, whether it's in Syria now, Iraq now, Afghanistan now, or back in South Vietnam during the war, all the national security correspondents, the press corps, know exactly what's going on, but they have a deal with the CIA. If they want to keep having access to the plans and strategies and programs that the CIA is clandestinely operating in that country, they have to keep their mouths shut. And if some national security correspondent gets moralistic about it, well, his editor and his publisher will fire him, send him off to Siberia. So it really is no distinction between the press and the CIA. These are the same people, the same class of people, and they have the same exact interests, and they have the same exact filters for making sure that nobody who is ideologically can't be assimilated is dispensed with. It never gets into that club. And again, these things have been solidified in America through the kind of organizational geniuses and management structures that were used to create the Phoenix program. These people are adept at creating the social structures and the political structures that keep us repressed. And they do the same thing in the United States that they do overseas. And I had the added advantage of being able to talk to close to 100 CIA officers who were involved in the Phoenix program. And they thought that William Colby, who was at one time the director of Central Intelligence and was the CIA officer most associated with the Phoenix program, he had actually liked my idea for a book, and it helped me, and it introduced me to a lot of these CIA officers, and they spoke openly to me. So even though it's a difficult subject to understand, and even though talking about systems management assumes that you have a capacity to understand how a lot of different systems are being juxtaposed, and that's difficult, and it's off-putting to a lot of people. But if you really want to understand how it goes, you have to spend the time trying to learn about it. You can't understand the petrochemical industry in a day. You know, I mean, these things take a lot of serious study, and the Phoenix program was written with that in mind. That book that came out in 19 was that it would be a serious study that people will have to really spend a lot of time looking at in order to understand the complexities of political repression and social repression. It's not something that you can just say, well, Donald Trump's a billionaire, and of course he's going to do it. You really got to understand the intricacies of it if you want to unravel it.
I can certainly appreciate the complexity of it after looking at your book on the Phoenix program. You have mentioned that the Phoenix program was run by the CIA, and the CIA is considered a civilian organization rather than a military one. And you've already pointed out that of course they worked together to implement the Phoenix program in Vietnam. That's a very complex interaction. With regard to the war on terror, homeland security, but specifically the Phoenix program in Vietnam, how would you analyze who had the upper hand? In your book, you've pointed out that the most important thing about counterterror was collecting intelligence. That was the most important thing. So did that make CIA structure really more important than the military?
Yeah, in a word. Because each of these two organizations, you know, the Pentagon and the Department of Defense on the one hand, has a mandate, a congressional mandate. The military even has its own judicial system. It's a huge, immense society that exists somewhat apart, but parallel to civilian American society. And historically, the military at the highest levels is commanded by civilians. The president is a civilian, and he is the commander in chief. And historically, with the United States, it's thought that in order to preserve democratic institutions, civilians have to manage the military. And so there's this presumption in a country like South Vietnam that the U.S. Embassy will be aware of everything that the military is doing. And the ambassador in any country will exercise control over the military. The military can't decide on its own to go into Hemlan provinces in Afghanistan and start blowing up villages. They have to get their okay from the embassy and also from the National Security Council in the White House, which is another civilian organization reporting directly to the president. Well, the CIA is a civilian organization, even though it has a special activities division, which is paramilitary in nature. Its paramilitary force operates clandestinely, covertly, and you never hear about it. You'll not hear about the CIA paramilitary forces that are operating around the world. And that's because the CIA paramilitary forces are targeted against civilians. As soon as you start fighting soldiers in another country, then the military comes in. And their mandate is to fight the military forces in another country. But the CIA fights guerrillas. It fights militias like you'll find in Iraq. It'll fight an organization that's said to be a non-state actor like ISIS. It has a very specific mandate to wage these kind of secret wars that are political in nature and aimed at civilians, not military forces. The other thing that the CIA does, which is, you know, part of this complex interaction with the military, it covertly begins experimental programs like the Phoenix program that the military will take over once that program, which has been developed clandestinely, covertly, is ready to go public. And you don't hear, again, you won't hear about that in the press because it's considered a national security secret that the CIA will be organizing paramilitary forces or militias in a foreign country, hiring civilians from that country to work, not for their own government, but for the United States government, either to act as counterinsurgents or, as in Syria, to act as insurgents trying to overthrow another government. The CIA is absolutely and totally responsible to do those things. If it rises to the point where a war begins, then the military comes in and takes over. So there's actually congressional mandates which absolutely define where the CIA can go. And there are congressional mandates that define where the military can go. And there's attorneys in the State Department making sure that both these organizations play by the rules. So we may not know the detail, but it's all very carefully managed so that nobody is really stepping on anybody's toes. Plus which, a program like Phoenix was instituted to more perfectly coordinate CIA and military operations. And that's the beauty of it for the top managers in the National Security Council or anywhere in the civilian government in the United States. They have now refined these systems and the way to organize and manage them so that the Phoenix model can be perfectly applied anywhere around the world. And the CIA in 2015 actually reorganized itself. You can read about it in the New York Times. Apart from creating a new digital innovations division to handle all its keystroking and hacking of foreign governments and our own and friendly governments, it actually has created 10, 15, 20 of these Phoenix-style centers around the world and is now organizing itself in this manner so it can more perfectly coordinate with military forces and the State Department in countries where it's fighting this war on terror.
How large of a bureaucracy would you say that the CIA is? This sounds like it's gigantic.
I think it has a budget that's, you know, it's always hard to find out what the CIA budget is because it hides a lot of its budget in the military or organizations that are covering for it. Even that, like the DEA provides cover for CIA agents. You don't walk around when you're in the CIA with a little badge that says, "Hi, I'm in the CIA." Every CIA officer that's overseas has a cover. CIA, as part of its congressional mandate, can say to the State Department, "We want 100 of your positions this year." If you can say to the military, "We want 1,000 of your positions this year to cover our officers." So a lot of that money that's paying for CIA officers never gets acknowledged in any budget because it's all undercover. And if you were to say, "Well, the military's covering, you know, $5 billion for the CIA this year," well, then it wouldn't be the CIA anymore. So, but just what's up front is like $35 or $50 billion a year. Of course, the military is $750 billion a year. It's rapidly approaching a trillion. So the military is much bigger and it's a much bigger organization. But in terms of affecting policy and in terms of having a political impact in the foreign countries that the United States would like to occupy militarily or overthrow, the CIA has a much wider intelligence network. There was recently an article that just talked about, even though all the attention goes to the new Joint Special Operations Command and the special forces in the military, that the CIA is really the force behind all these special forces programs. And it's paving the way for them. The Joint Special Operations Command never goes into a country and starts operating there until the CIA has set the scene for them politically and corrupted the politicians in a particular country and made sure that they're going to allow the military to start sending special forces into a country. And the fact of the matter is that many of the highest ranking members of the military's Joint Special Operations Command are actually CIA officers operating under cover because, and it was the same back in Vietnam, you can't have the military going into a foreign country and wreaking political havoc. Everything has to be coordinated at a very high political level, which means liaison. The CIA has liaison with police officials, with government officials, with civilian officials, civilian businessmen, landowners, all sorts of people in foreign countries that are covert. And that's where the bread and butter is having this political support that allows the military to go in. Unless you understand that, you can't understand the distinction between the military and the CIA. And I can tell you right now, the American press corps is not going to tell you. They're not going to explain all this in the kind of detail that you need to know to understand not only the relationship between the CIA and its organization and operations overseas, but how it also it impacts things that happen here in the United States domestically.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, Phoenix as the Model for Homeland Security and the War on Terror. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. With regard to the Phoenix program in Vietnam specifically, you had extensive talks with this guy, Mr. Brickham, and he divided the operations, according to your book, of Phoenix into three categories. The Hamlet Informant Program, which concerned low-level informants in the villages and hamlets. The Province Interrogation Center Program and captured documents. And Agent Penetrations, that is recruitment in place of Viet Cong. I was thinking maybe you could talk about these three different operations and then ultimately about how some of these terror attacks that were instigated, that the people carrying them out would address as if they were Viet Cong. They were like false flag operations all over the place, where these people that would stage attacks, violent attacks on the Vietnamese infrastructure, which is actually the... well, just the people, they would be led to believe that these terror attacks were being carried out by the Viet Cong, when in fact they were being carried out by the South Vietnamese or the CIA or the U.S. military, right?
Absolutely. Nelson Brickham was a magna cum laude grad of Yale University who went into the CIA in 1949. He was a World War II veteran. Most of the CIA officers that I talked with were World War II veterans. They were older men. Most of them were retired. And because Comey, who, of course, was also a World War II veteran, he had parachuted into France with the OSS and organized resistance to Germany and the Germans. They were older generation, and they looked upon me. My father was a World War II generation guy. He was a veteran, World War II veteran. Because Comey had sent me to them, they looked at me paternalistically, and they liked me, which is one of the reasons the CIA got so mad at me, because guys like Brickham actually thought that I was sent by Comey to get the absolute truth about the Phoenix program. And so they spilled the beans. They told me things that you'll never hear a CIA officer talk about, things that you're not going to read about in a book written by some war correspondent who works for the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times or CBS. You know, they don't get anecdotal. They don't talk about at length. You're not going to read lengthy interviews with anybody from the CIA, but I got that access. And this guy, Brickham, talked for hours and days. I probably spent a week with him. All my interviews with him are on the Internet. They're online. Anybody who wants to listen to the interviews can go to them. I recorded them. So it's there. And that's one of the reasons that the CIA hated me so much. They started spying on me. When I was doing this book, they actually, you know, kept a file on me, which I got years later. But Brickham gave me the PhD level lesson in CIA operations. And that's all in the book. He talked not only about the Hamlet Informant Program, the interrogation centers and the value of agent penetrations. He talked about it in detail. He named the CIA officers who were involved in these programs. He told me about the conflicts and the competitions that CIA officers had amongst themselves and how these things affected operations. For example, Brigham was in the foreign intelligence staff. And within the CIA, the foreign intelligence staff works in liaison with secret policemen in foreign countries. Brigham's sort of main competitor was a guy named Donahue who ran the CIA's covert action program. Brigham described that as an intelligence gathering operation that works undercover. The covert action people created the hit teams, the counterterror teams. They created the armed propaganda teams. They created something that was called census grievance, in which the CIA teams would go into a village. Apart from the Hamlet informant program, with a little shack, a portable shack, and people could go in and talk to somebody from the South Vietnamese government about their grievances, you know, and supposedly they could do it without the police knowing about it. So there were all these different programs that were ongoing and were conflicting with them, and Brigham tried to bring them all to coordinate all of these even competitive CIA programs through the Phoenix program. All of a sudden now, the covert action people, that staff, would be working with the foreign intelligence staff. Brigham talked primarily about his programs as a foreign intelligence officer, which are the three programs you just mentioned, the Hamlet informant program, the interrogation center program, and agent penetrations. Through their liaison with the South Vietnamese police, Brigham and his foreign intelligence staff tried to recruit agents in every informants in every village in South Vietnam. It was a massive program totally funded by the CIA. The South Vietnamese police had no money. All the money came from the CIA. Brigham said it cost about $1 million a year for all his foreign intelligence programs in South Vietnam. Of course, there were these incentives so the police could make some money on the side, which I was talking about earlier. The covert action programs, the guy who ran them, Donahue, whose interviews are also online, told me that was about $25 million budget. So I even knew how much money they were ostensibly claiming. And Brigham said about the Hamlet informant program, the whole counterinsurgency depended on informants. I said, without informants, you're dead. With informants, you can do anything. So they poured a lot of money and a lot of intention into getting informants, just the way, I should add, the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI and police departments around the country in the United States today are actively going out and trying to get informants to, you know, through all sorts of different programs that Department of Homeland Security is creating here in the United States. Same thing. Law enforcement can do anything if it has informants. It can't do much if it doesn't. So, you know, it's important to understand that system is applied here as well. The big deal were the interrogation centers and the agent penetrations as well. Brigham introduced me to the CIA officer who ran the interrogation center program in South Vietnam, a guy named John Muldoon, who I spent a couple of days with. I met him at his brother's polo farm. His brother was a fabulously wealthy attorney in Washington who owned polo farm, huge, you know, I mean, with the white fences for miles, you know, and the horses prancing around and all that stuff, and guys with funny hats swinging sticks. Muldoon ran the interrogation center program. I spent 2 days with him, and he outlined to me the whole interrogation center program. The whole idea was to build an interrogation center in each province in South Vietnam, which was run by the special branch of the South Vietnamese police. A CIA foreign intelligence officer in each province was in a liaison relationship. He was an advisor to the top special branch, South Vietnamese special branch officer in the province. And together, they would work on identifying members of the National Liberation Front. Informants would, you know, say, well, Vin, you know, over in that village, he is the party's district leader. And so the CIO would send a hit team from the covert action program to grab this guy, and they bring him to the interrogation center. The CIA started building these interrogation centers in early 1965. The company they hired to actually oversee the construction was an American corporation called Pacific Architects and Engineers. They had a blueprint. The CIA would buy property on the outskirts of the capital in the province, you know, buy 10, 20, 30 acres, clear it off. Pacific Architects and Engineers would hire a local South Vietnamese contractor, and they would go in, they would build an interrogation center. I describe them in the book and at length with this interview with Muldoon. And they would then give free of charge this interrogation center to the South Vietnamese police special branch. And they would, the CIA would train the officers, the South Vietnamese police special branch officers who worked in it. They would train them how to interrogate people. There was usually about 75 cells. I outlined the whole detail of them. They're pretty much the model for all the black sites. These Phoenix interrogation centers, they almost look exactly, if you've ever seen a picture of like the black sites that the CIA has in Poland or Thailand or wherever, they basically use the same model. And the CIA, so they build an interrogation center in every province, and hired the special branch people to run them, paid all their salaries, and they bugged them so that they wiretapped them, and they bugged the phones. The CIA would, you know, wiretap the phones so that anything that the special branch people were saying, they would hear that too. And all the reports that came out of these interrogation centers were sent to CIA headquarters in Saigon. And if they got a clue about somebody who was very important in the National Liberation Front, rather than going after that person, they would begin an agent penetration operation, which is, according to Brigham, the most important thing that the CIA does. So now you get into real espionage intelligence operations when you start talking about agent penetrations. You know, you've got a guy in the interrogation center, and he says, you know, leave me alone, don't kill my family, and I'll tell you who the district party chief is. The member of the National Liberation Front, who's a member of the Communist Party, the Lao Dong Party, I'll give you his name. And at that point, and I describe the process in detail in my new book, The CIA is Organized Crime, how the recruitment process, I didn't have time to do it in the Phoenix Program book, but I do it in this new book. They begin an agent penetration operation, which are very complex. It's the nuts and bolts of what the CIA does in liaison with the special police in a foreign nation. It's the big thing that they do everywhere. And they try to get, as an agent, somebody who's in the in South Vietnam, they tried to get people working for who are actually in the National Liberation Front. And if they could get them in, a guy working for them or a woman working for them, they would leave them in place for 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years if they could. And they would protect these people. And these people would report back to the CIA and the special branch of the South Vietnamese police the plans and intentions and strategies. So all throughout South Vietnam, at the same time that the Phoenix program was trying to pacify through violence, intense violence and coercion, of the threat of going to these courts where simply being informed upon that you were going to go to prison without, because you had no defense. At the same time, they were pacifying the lower level, the rural population. They were working to preserve the higher levels of the National Liberation Front. They're actually protecting it throughout the whole country. Part of it had to do with the fact that if the CIA and the South Vietnamese Special Branch started bumping off the senior level people of the National Liberation Front, well, they would go start bumping off all the senior level people of the South Vietnamese Special Branch. They all knew each other. They were related to each other.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, Phoenix as the model for homeland security and the war on terror. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
I had one CIA guy tell me this story. His name was Ed Brady. My interviews with him are available on the internet as well at a place called Cryptocom. They're all there. And Brady was working for the Phoenix Directorate, and he was working in liaison with a very senior South Vietnamese Special Branch officer. And they were going around, and they were inspecting Phoenix program operations around South Vietnam. They, you know, just like management does, you know, you got to go look at the factory here or the warehouse there, you know, and make sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to do. And Brady was working in Saigon at a very high level for the CIA. And he was working with a very high-level special branch guy. And they went to a city called Da Lat, which is in central Vietnam. And they're sitting in a little cafe. And the South Vietnamese guy says to Brady, "That's the province chief's wife." He said, "That's the South Vietnamese wife, and she's going around getting the monthly payoffs here in this restaurant from people from in this diner." And Brady said, "Well, why doesn't she have one of her subordinates doing it?" And he said, "Well, it's not the South Vietnamese province chief. That's the National Liberation Front province chief. But I know her, you know, and I know her husband. I mean, we all know each other." And Brady said, "Well, let's grab her. Let's set up an operation. Let's, you know, so we can ambush and capture her husband." And the South Vietnamese guy looked at him and he said, "Well, you know, Ed, you're going to be gone in 6 months or maybe a year. But I got to live here, man. And if I start laying a trap for his wife and I start using his children as bait, what do you think they're going to do to me?" And so there was at the very highest levels of this intelligence war, there was what was called a modus vivendi. An accommodation had been reached. And the people who suffered, as in any country, were the poor people. And they're the ones that got smeared and creamed and stomped upon. And there was no protection for them. But through these agent penetration operations, there was another, that's where the modus vivendi was carried out. So they're so sophisticated. The things that are going on are so detailed and so vast that you have to understand that this is the way the CIA operates in every country around the world. It's doing the same thing in Great Britain. It's doing the same thing in France. It's doing this in Ukraine. It took the CIA 20 years to get enough agents and enough agent penetrations and to corrupt enough secret policemen in Ukraine so that they could pull off the coup there that they pulled off a couple of years ago. That's something that the CIA does. That's not something that the military does. And the formation of paramilitary forces in Ukraine, that's something that the CIA does. It may have a military guy who's detailed to them, you know, and leaves the military special forces and goes to work for the CIA. He's not actually a CIA employee, you know, with life insurance and retirement fund and all that stuff. He's just detailed. You know, the CIA will have a lot of those military people come in and help them to organize militias and flesh out these operations. And they work very closely with military intelligence doing these sorts of things. But that's what the CIA does. And even in a country what we're at war with or occupying militarily, like Iraq or Afghanistan, the CIA is handling these political and police operations apart from the military. And as Nelson Brigham stressed to me, any insurgency, counterinsurgency, is essentially a police affair, not a military affair, because you have to have informants in the civilian population. You have to have these secret interrogation centers where you can work the civilians over, and a system of courts set up where you can send them to prison and coerce them extra legally. And you have to have these modus vivendi through these agent penetration operations that protect the secret policemen, so they don't have to worry about getting bumped off, and they can operate for years. And you corrupt them, and you give them all sorts of money and gadgets and in some cases Swiss bank accounts, so that they'll let you do all these extra legal things. And these systems have all been perfected in the 75 years that the CIA has been operating, and now they're computerized, and now they're assimilated into the internet and all the digital things that are going on, and the guidelines with the military are refined. It's absolutely misinformation, and in some cases disinformation, by people in the media, left, right, central, it doesn't matter, to think that somehow the military and the CIA are working at odds with each other. They are very closely coordinated. They're indistinguishable from each other. And especially when it comes to the special forces, they're basically the same thing. And in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command are absolutely compatible and indistinguishable.
In the Province Interrogation Center program, were you told about torture when you were interviewing a lot of these people who had been in the Phoenix program in Vietnam?
Yeah, the guy who told me about it, this guy John Patrick Muldoon, said absolutely, you know, and he blamed it on the South Vietnamese. He said, well, the South Vietnamese used the old French methods, but of course, it's a secret program. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request for all the information that the CIA had on this PIC program, the Province Interrogation Center program. They won't release the files on them, but there are files detailing everything that happened in every one of these interrogation center programs. So the knowledge, again, is there. And, of course, the ultimate was the Tiger Cages at Con Son Prison, 90 miles off the coast of South Vietnam, which was sort of the mother of all interrogation centers. And it was the place where all the high-ranking captured civilians who were in the National Liberation Front were sent. They were sent to Con Son Prison, and that's where the infamous Tiger Cages were, which were really no better than anything that was going on in these interrogation centers. It's just a concrete cell. People were shackled into position, into a sitting position, and left there for a year. Their legs would deteriorate. There were pictures after the ceasefire in 1972 of some of the people that were released, and they're actually sitting on little, like, skateboards because they couldn't use their legs anymore and just pushing themselves around. So the level of torture that was going on in these interrogation centers beyond anything you can imagine, and it's never been reported. And it's one of the deepest, darkest secrets of the CIA's involvement in the Vietnam War. And not only has it never been reported, but it'll never be. Nobody will ever be able to make a case because it amounted to war crimes on a massive scale, beyond what anybody could ever imagine. And like I said, these interrogation centers have become the model for like the black sites that the CIA sets up all around the world. Pacific Architects Engineers was the construction company that designed them.
And finally, you write in your book on the Phoenix program, Phoenix symbolizes an aspect of the Vietnam War that changed forever the way Americans think about themselves and their government. Central to Phoenix is the fact that it targeted civilians, not soldiers.
Yeah. And guess what? The people that run our society feel the same way about us, the citizens of the United States, that they feel about the citizens of South Vietnam. They may tell you that you're special because you're an American, but you're not. And the income inequality divide gets bigger and bigger. And as the Department of Homeland Security spreads its informant nets and its the same programs that the CIA created in South Vietnam, as these, this is the same thing they have in store for us here. It's why it's important to understand the systems, how the systems are used to manipulate political and social movements, the systems behind political repression, which in the United States are highly refined, but we're civilians too. And all these programs that were perfected in South Vietnam and perfected over the years are being turned on us. And the historical arc is there, and you can see it happening before your eyes. And it's going in a predetermined direction, and it's not going to get any better.
Douglas Valentine, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for letting me talk at length. There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear.
There's a man with a gun over there. I've been speaking with Douglas Valentine. Today's show has been Phoenix as the Model for Homeland Security and the War on Terror. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program about the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology, With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. His latest book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World, available at claritypress.com. The Phoenix Program is published by the Forbidden Bookshelf. Visit his website at douglasvalentine.com. That's douglasvalentine.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio. Hey!
Evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call for all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look what's inside yourself for peace.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, jotted down by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Our show today was originally broadcast in 2010. I think it has held up well over the years. I hope you agree. Today we'll start by looking at the political and economic plight of nearby Haiti. Then we'll step back and look at the broader picture, for Haiti is just an especially clear example of some truly awful global trends. Journalist Johan Hari will discuss the economic exploitation of Haiti. Michael Parenti will show parallels to several other third world countries, quote unquote. And to lighten things up a bit, comedians Bob and Ray will give a comic report on labor management relations from about 1960. Comic, maybe, but all too true. I hope you'll stay tuned. Haiti made the news twice this year. In January, the island suffered a devastating earthquake. In response, the U.S. military sent thousands of troops onto the island. They took over the Port-au-Prince airport to serve their own expedition. This prevented flights carrying relief supplies from landing. What the troops were doing is anybody's guess, for apparently they didn't bring any relief supplies for the Haitians. The best guess I heard was this. This was a military exercise preparing for a future invasion of Venezuela. Haiti made the news later when American pop singer Wyclef Jean announced his intention to run for president of Haiti. Their elections come in November. Jean wasn't allowed to run, nor was the person the Haitians overwhelmingly want to be president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, whom the United States twice deposed. Let's hear the story from that fine British journalist Johan Hari, writing in The Independent on September 17. I've condensed his piece for radio. It's titled, Suffocating the Poor, A Modern Parable. Subhead: they democratically elected a president to stand up to the rich and multinational corporations. So our governments had him kidnapped. Across the world, the poor are kept poor so that the rich can be kept rich. If you grasp the situation, you will see some of the ugliest forces in the world laid out before you, so we can figure out how to stop them. The rubble-strewn island of Haiti is now in the middle of an election campaign that will climax this November. So far, the world has noticed it solely because the Haitian-American musician Wyclef Jean wanted to run for president, only to be blocked because he hasn't lived in the country since he was a kid. But there is a much bigger hole in the election. The most popular politician in Haiti by far, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He's not there because, after winning a landslide election, he followed the will of the Haitian people, who demanded he take on the multinational corporations and redistribute enough money that their children wouldn't starve. So our governments had him kidnapped at gunpoint and refused to let him back. Sidebar comment, this was the second time we overthrew Aristide, in February 2004. Back to the text. But we have to start the story a little earlier if this is going to make sense. For over two centuries, outsiders have controlled Haiti. The French enslaved the entire island in the 18th century and worked much of the population to death on sugar and coffee plantations. By the 20th century, Western governments were arming, funding, and fueling the psychopathic dictatorship of the Duvalier family, who slaughtered 50,000 people. All this left Haiti the most unequal country in the world. A tiny elite lives in vast villas in the hills, while below and all around them, the overwhelming majority of the population live in tiny tin shacks with no water or electricity, crammed six to a room. Just 1% of the people own 50% of the wealth and 75% of the arable land. Once the Haitian people were finally able to rise up in 1986 to demand democracy, they obviously wanted the country's wealth to be shared more fairly. They began to organize into a political movement called Lavalas, the Flood, to demand higher wages and higher taxes on the rich, to build schools and hospitals, and subsidies for the half-starved poor. This panicked the elite. And nobody panicked them more than a thin, softly spoken, intellectual slum priest named Aristide, who found himself at the crest of this wave. He was born into a bitingly poor family and became a brilliant student. As a priest, he soon became one of the leading exponents of liberation theology, the left-wing Catholicism that says people shouldn't wait passively for justice in the kingdom of heaven, but must demand it here and now. Cardinal Ratzinger, then head of the Inquisition, tried desperately to stamp out this, quote, heresy, unquote. Ratzinger is now Pope. Aristide explained, quote, the rich of my country, a tiny percentage, sit at a vast table overflowing with good food, while the rest of my countrymen are crowded under that table, hunched in the dirt and starving. One day the people under the table will rise up in righteousness. Unquote. On this platform, he was elected in 1990 in a landslide in that country's first free and fair election, taking 64% of the vote. He kept his promise to the Haitian people. He increased the minimum wage from 38 cents a day to $1 a day, demanding that multinational corporations pay a less insulting wage. He tripled the number of free secondary schools. He disbanded the murderous national army that had terrorized the population. Even the International Monetary Fund had to admit that over the Aristide period and just after, Haiti's human poverty indicator dropped dramatically from 46.2% to 31.8%. This is a measure of how likely your kids are to die, starve, or go uneducated. But why would foreign governments care about a small, poor country with only 10 million inhabitants? Ira Kurtzban, an American lawyer based in Haiti, explains, quote, Aristide represented a threat to foreign powers because he spoke for the 85% of his population who had never been heard. If that can happen in Haiti, it can happen anywhere, including in countries where the U.S. and Europe have huge economic interests and extract natural resources. They don't want real popular democracies to spread because they know it will confront U.S. economic interests, unquote. Oxfam called this phenomenon, quote, the threat of a good example, unquote. So, after Haiti had experienced 7 months of democracy, the U.S. toppled Aristide in September 1991. Ordinary Haitians surrounded his home, calling for his return, and they were shot down so indiscriminately that more ammo had to be sent from Guantanamo Bay on Cuba. Their bodies were left in the streets to be eaten by dogs. In 1994, the Clinton administration agreed to return Aristide to power, provided he castrate his own political program and ignore the demands of his people. They made him agree to privatize almost everything, freeze wages, and sack half the civil service. Through gritted teeth, he agreed, and for the remainder of his time in office, tried to struggle through what little progress he could. He was reelected in an even bigger landslide in 2000, but even his tiny shuffles toward redistribution were too much. In 2004, the U.S. and French governments had Aristide kidnapped at gunpoint and dumped him in the Central African Republic. They said he was a dictator, even though the last Gallup poll in a free Haiti found 60% supported him, compared to just 3% backing the alternative imposed on the country by the U.S. A massive campaign of terror and repression followed. The Lavalas party was banned from running again. Most of the country's democracy activists were jailed. There were huge military assaults on the slums, which demanded Aristide's return. A U.S. Army official explained that the mission was to ensure the Haitians, quote, don't get the idea they can do anything they want, unquote. The next president, René Préval, learned his lesson. He has done everything he was told to by the corporations and governments. He privatized the last remaining scraps owned by the state and used tear gas to break up strikes for higher wages. The Haitian people rejected the whole rigged electoral process, with turnout falling to just under 11%. Today, Aristide is a broken man, living in exile in South Africa, banned from going home. This is part of a pattern. When poor countries got uppity and tried to ask for basic justice, our governments have toppled them. From Iran, wanting to control its own oil in 1953, to Honduras, wanting its workers to be treated decently in 2009. Sidebar comment, and dozens of other examples in between. Back to the text. You don't have to overthrow many governments to terrify the rest. It doesn't have to be this way. This is not the will of the people, in the U.S. or Europe. On the contrary, ordinary citizens are horrified when the propaganda is stripped away and they see the truth. It only happens because a tiny, wealthy elite dominates our foreign policy and uses it to serve their purposes. Low wages and control of other people's economies and resources. The people of Haiti, who have nothing, were bold and brave enough to campaign and organize to take power back from their undemocratic elites. Are we? End of Johann Hari's excellent article, Suffocating the Poor, A Modern Parable. And is the United States heading in the same direction as Haiti? Well, the average wage isn't yet down to 38 cents a day, but we're clearly headed in that direction rather than in the opposite direction. Since 1970, real wages have declined, social benefits have declined, job security has vanished, pensions have been destroyed, jobs have been moved abroad, unions have been destroyed, access to health care has diminished, homelessness has skyrocketed. The richest 1% has gotten much, much richer, while everyone else has gotten poorer. And through legislation and regulation and deregulation, the United States government has actively worked to bring about these changes and has blocked almost every attempt to reverse the trend. 50 years ago, the comedy team of Bob and Ray had a vision of the third worldization of the American economy. It must have seemed extremely, absurdly funny back in 1960, a time of rising wages and benefits and high employment. I suspect it seems less funny today and closer to the literal truth. Still, as far as dystopian visions go, it's a lot funnier than Orwell's 1984 or Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Here are Bob and Ray with an admiring report on the Great Lakes Paperclip Company.
Okay, Wally Blue is standing by in Napoleon, Ohio, with a report. Come in, please, Wally Blue.
Lee Blue here in Napoleon, Ohio. At the Great Lakes Paperclip Company, I have been conducting a survey of industrialists who are trying to contribute to the economic health of our nation, and I've come here to speak to the president of the firm, Mr. Hudley Pierce. Thank you for the warm welcome you gave me, Hudley.
Well, thank you. We're always pleased to have visitors here at the plant.
I was amazed to find such a huge factory devoted to the manufacture of such a small item as paperclips.
Well, actually, we're one of the small fellows in the business. There are several companies much bigger than ours in the paperclip business, but we all have the same problems, waste, inefficiency, goofing off, so forth.
Certainly, but you've been doing your best to fight that sort of thing. I was impressed in that one building I saw. I know you have others, but in that one, there was no machinery whatsoever.
No, we don't have any machinery. You see, we buy our wire in long strips, and then our workers cut them in shorter strips, and then bend them by hand into paper clips.
You must have to get a tremendous price for your product if it's handmade like that.
No, we're actually holding the line on cost there. We sell a box of 100 for 10 cents.
Wow.
And here at the factory for 6 cents a box in gross lots.
How many boxes can you turn out in, say, a week's time?
Well, with all three shifts going, we could make, 200 boxes maybe. And we can clear about $12.
I mean, you can run a big operation like I've seen here and only take in $12 a week?
Well, we have a low wage structure. You see, here again we hold the line on costs. Our average worker makes about 14 cents a week.
That is ridiculous. How could anybody possibly live on 14 cents a week?
We don't pry into the personal lives of our employers, Molly. But as I understand it, our people live in caves on the edge of town, and they forage for food.
I noticed all of your employees seem to be dressed in rags. They have little strips of cloth tied around their feet.
Well, you can't wear shoes when you make 14 cents a week. That's obvious to everybody.
I guess so. That would probably account for a lot of the grumbling I heard while I was over there.
I'm sure it would, yes.
Still can't understand how anybody can work on a salary like you've described.
Well, there are a few loopholes in our union contract. For instance, there's no mention of wages at all. But there is a provision that makes the worker liable for prosecution and imprisonment if he tries to quit.
I imagine the union will have that changed the first chance it gets, huh?
Well, no, we have what's called a 99-year sweetheart contract. And it has 86 years to run, so we're in pretty good shape.
Well, you've got some time to look ahead, Mr. Pearson. Thanks again for the welcome I got out here. A tip of our hat to you in your fight against all of this waste and corruption.
Thank you very much.
Hudley Pierce, the Great Lakes Paperclip Factory. Thank you, Hudley.
Now let's look at the broader picture. Since World War II, the United States has invaded lots and lots of countries and overthrown lots and lots of governments, many of them friendly to the U.S., many of them democracies. In a lecture from, I believe, 1993, political scientist Michael Perante shows what these countries had in common. They attempted to introduce economic reforms to better serve their own common people. They tried to be something other than just a colony to transnational neoliberal capitalism and its enforcement arm, the United States government. Sometimes they merely tried to raise the minimum wage the foreign sweatshop owners would have to pay their workers, as happened in Honduras just last year. The name Haiti comes up again and again, along with dozens of other names. Here's a selection from Michael Parenti.
The U.S. empire has given more than $200 billion in military aid to train, equip, and subsidize over 2 million troops and internal security forces in over as 80 countries. The purpose is being not to defend them from outside invasion, but to defend the ruling oligarchs in these countries from their own populations. Among the recipients of U.S. military aid have been some of the worst murderers and military autocracies on earth, such as Turkey, Zaire, Chad, Morocco, Kuwait, Indonesia, and others too numerous to mention. Haiti, before Aristide, and after Aristide. Over the past four decades, the U.S. launched or assisted in the overthrow of popular governments in Guatemala, Guyana, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Greece, Argentina, Bolivia, and Haiti in 91, and numerous other countries. And then supported the conservative military autocracies that replaced them. Well, now, if a goal of U.S. foreign policy is democracy, how do you serve the cause of democracy throughout the world by overthrowing so many democracies? And why did you overthrow them? Hostile actions by the U.S. leaders have been directed against reformist governments in Egypt, South Yemen, Lebanon, Peru, Iran under Mossadegh, the Congo under Lumumba, the Fiji Islands, and you can go on. Since World War II, U.S. military forces have directly invaded or launched aerial attacks, killing large numbers of people in Vietnam, the Dominican Republic, Laos, Cambodia, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Libya, Iraq, and Somalia. Before World War II, the U.S. invaded Haiti, Soviet Russia, China, Nicaragua, Cuba, Mexico, Puerto Rico, the Philippines. The nations that feel the brunt of U.S. intervention are not randomly selected. Generally, intervention is directed against governments that have sought to establish political economic independence, governments that have either tried to drop out of the global free market capitalist system or, within the confines of it, tried some kind of independent development and redistributive politics. By redistributive politics, I mean that they took some portion of the gross national income and redistributed from column A to column B, from the people in column A, that 2% that live off interest and dividends and land royalties and rents, to the people in column B, the other 98% who live off wages, salaries, commissions, fees, and pensions. And those are the governments, those governments that have pursued that kind of policy are the ones which have been targeted for U.S. intervention. It could be a populist military government, as in Panama under Torrijos and Noriega, or in Egypt under Nasser. It could be a Christian revolutionary one, as in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas. It could be a social democratic popular front government, as in Chile under Allende, or in Greece under Papandreou back in the 1960s. It could be a Marxist-Leninist one, as in Cuba or North Korea or Soviet Union. It can be an Islamic revolutionary government, as in Libya under Gaddafi. Even a conservative militarist government, as in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. I mean, Saddam Hussein was CIA. I mean, who do you think brought him in and got the king out of Iraq? It was the CIA. But he got to be a little too nationalistic. He started to get out of line on oil prices and oil quotas. The goal of U.S. global policy is to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. The purpose is not just to protect direct investments. I mean, there was very little direct investment, U.S. investment in Vietnam, for instance, or in Soviet Russia back in 1920 when the U.S. invaded with 12 other countries. It's to protect the overall global capitalist system. Take the case of Grenada. I remember saying to an acquaintance, I said, why doesn't Reagan invade Grenada? I mean, here's a little revolutionary country of 102,000 people. It's perfectly helpless, and he's a bully, and he would take it, you know, and is trying a revolutionary course. And then I came to the conclusion, and it was foolish of me to say this, I said, oh, it's too small. It's ridiculous to go take U.S. forces and invade. And I didn't realize that nothing's too small for Ronald Reagan. And sure enough, he invaded Grenada. Well, what's the purpose of it? Capitalism would not collapse if Grenada remained revolutionary. And Reagan was right. It wasn't a matter of direct resources that you needed from that country. He said, nutmeg is not the question. I mean, that was Grenada's biggest export. We could get perfectly good nutmeg from Africa. You don't need Grenada's nutmeg. So why did they invade Grenada? They invaded Grenada because they were serving notice to the people of the Caribbean and to the people of Latin America and to the people of the world that you cannot drop out of your client state free market system. That if you try to take an independent source, and that if you use your land, your labor, your resources, and your capital, and your markets in a different way, in a collectivist way, if you use them to benefit the needs of your people rather than to be milked like a cow for foreign investors or whatever else, if you do that, this is what's going to happen to you. And the rest of the Caribbean got the message. In the same way, the reason Indonesia invaded East Timor. There may be oil in East Timor, or there may not. But the thing that there was a revolutionary government that was trying to effect these kinds of social changes. And this counter-revolutionary policy prevails regardless of the party or personality that's in the White House. Whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, it doesn't matter. This policy obtains. The process of keeping the world's land, labor, resources accessible at cheap prices for the multinational investors, that process has a name. It's called imperialism, the I word, which is really not allowed to be mentioned very often. And if you're practicing imperialism, then you have an empire. So in its financial and in its military reach, the United States empire builders have created the greatest empire in history, far greater in scope and power than Great Britain in the 19th century or Rome of ancient times. The goods made abroad by super-exploited labor are, by the way, sold at as high as possible price on U.S. markets. You could hear people say, well, maybe I get a break as the consumer. They go abroad, but they produce those goods more cheaply, and I get to buy them more cheaply. That's not true. Now, come on, now, be real. Be grown up. It's amazing people you run into, the kind of goo-goo baby-like thinking they have about the people up there in power, hoping that they'll be benign to us, you know. Maybe they're doing this for me. They're doing it for you? You think they went all the way to Indonesia for you? You think Nike has closed every single one of its factories in America and went to Indonesia, where they pay these young women in compounds, which amount to slave labor, they pay them 10 and 12 cents an hour? You think they did that for you? No, because when those shoes, which the final production cost is $7, when those shoes get back stateside, they sell them for $134. They don't go there for you. They go there for themselves to widen that margin, to get cheap labor costs so that they can then make more profits. When they go down to Haiti and employ people for $1 a day, and that radical President Aristide wants to raise the minimum wage to $2. The World Bank got him against the wall, said, you're going to go back, but you just drop that stuff about minimum wage and those crazy radical ideas. It costs 10 cents to make a baseball in Haiti. No, I'm sorry, wait a minute. 12 cents. It costs 12 cents to make a baseball. They stitch those baseballs in Haiti, which then sell here in the U.S. for $10 and up. What's the markup on that, 12 cents to $10? How many 1,000%? Even take off for transportation costs, whatever else.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. For more information, great links and pretty pictures, plus my email address if you'd care to get in touch, see our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Now I get to my non-carborundum, and let's keep trying to live each day as though the truth were true. Let's go out on a bit of music by Haitian-American singer Wyclef Jean.
You hear the choir, you don't want no drama. Someone gonna end up in a coma. Drama, can't they hear the choir? Someone gonna end up in a coma. I got the heart of a warrior. Ain't a thing that you can do to hide. You won the battle, but you didn't win the war. Look out the window, see 100,000 more. Warriors, warriors, warriors. See, I'm a warrior, and I don't back down. When I'm hit up, bite the bullet, brush myself off. Then I see the fear clear in my enemy's eyes. He see the warrior, now where my warriors? Yeah, yeah. Warriors come out to play in my gangland's revolutionary music. But I got a cousin in the gang. He used to bang, gave me a brain. He said, cousin, let me tell you a reason. If a man snitch, we call that treason. I never left the hood without my body armor. I was raised on the cold, death before dishonor. And what's funny, I could have been that way. If I never made it, red dot pointed at your head. And send you to your new home, a mansion in the ocean. Where your flesh will be carried to land by Miami Dolphins. I ain't no gangster, but I know gangsters. I ain't no killer. Are you a killer? Cause I seen killers kill killers, robbing drug dealers. That's why I'd rather sell music with my online warriors. You hear the choir.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded. true. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. This show was previously aired in 2013. As you listen to it, think about the new fake news propaganda and promised censorship that we're currently experiencing in 2016. The Northern California 9/11 truthers put on an event to mark the 11th anniversary, and today you're going to hear two of the speeches from that event. The first one is Mickey Huff, who runs Project Censored. And the second one is Peter Phillips, who is the director of the Media Freedom Foundation. Google Project Censored and the Media Freedom Foundation, and you'll get to their websites and read about the many shocking stories being censored by the corporate media. Both of these gentlemen are university professors. So first, let's begin with Mickey Huff.
I'd like to thank everybody here that's now clapping for everybody else, because you're the ones that are also showing us, each other, and anybody else that there are people that really do care in America about things of great import. I would not only like to recognize today as the 11th anniversary of the events of September the 11th, 2001, I'd like to remember all of the victims of imperialism and globalist greed throughout the centuries, not just on the 9/11s from New York or Chile. 35,000 people a day starve to death. We need to have more wars, maybe that are based on constructive compassion to help alleviate the world's problems, not destroy people and the earth in the process. I'd like to speak tonight also then about, given that this is the 11th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, I'd like to talk about the process of anniversary. And Andy Lee Roth, the Associate Director of Project Censored, and Dr. Paul Ray, with whom I've worked on sections of the upcoming book, Censored 2013, and Peter Phillips, of course, whom we'll be speaking here very shortly, we've really been tackling these issues in our new work, these anniversaries, this concept of unhistory. Noam Chomsky, not long ago, was writing about this phenomenon of unhistory, and I'm a professor of history, and I really focus a lot of time on these unhistories, meaning the histories that are supported by factual evidence but don't seem to make it into the history books, right? We're familiar with Howard Zinn and James Loewen and Francis Fitzgerald and many, many, many others over the years that have helped bring these vernacular narratives and counter-narratives to light that are really based on factual evidence, but they get suppressed through the process of officializing narratives, narratives based on mythologies, not factual realities. And as you all know here, the events of 9/11 really kind of fit into a whole stream of mythic narratives that get blurred, obfuscated, distorted, converted into Hallmark postcards and bumper stickers, and used as means to raise money to further empire. And this is, again, a process that needs extraordinarily deconstructed. Michael Peretti, another progressive leftist historian, wrote in a work called History is Mystery, "Those engaged in the manufacturing of history often introduce distortions at the point of origin, well before history is written or even played out. This initial process of control is not usually left to chance, but is regularly pursued by interested parties who are situated to manipulate the record." William Casey, director of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1981, stated, leaving an early meeting with Reagan and his cabinet, quote, "We'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American people believe is false." Are we there yet? For several years now, we at Project Censored have been describing the Americans' general lack of awareness about what's going on in the country and the world as a literal and ongoing truth emergency. It is a state of psychic numbing and information overload, one which results from the ubiquitous din of establishment propaganda and top-down managed news. These are very specific terms that I'm using for a reason. Many Americans don't know what they don't know, and many can't discern between what is real and manufactured. Still others show little interest outside their daily lives. Although our culture is awash in information, many citizens often lack an adequate understanding of what that information really means. because the institutions that disseminate this information, particularly the news media, I'd like to make a correction from Barry Zwicker, with all due respect. It is not the mainstream media. It is the corporate media. It is the megaphone of the 1%. It is the mechanism of thought control in our society that is most ubiquitously used. And it is a great achievement of corporate propaganda that we say mainstream media, because we're the mainstream, not the corporate media. So stop saying mainstream media unless you're talking about your media. We gotta watch how we talk. We have to watch the words we use, because they have meaning. And we all slide into these meanings. And we all need to make friendly nudges to each other when we are found using the terms that come from the ruling class to describe our own lives. We need to have our own vernacular narratives and reclaim these narratives for the common good. The only way we can do that is by working together and being mutually respectful. And I am saying this with all due respect to Barry or any others whom I've said this to. It is not a negative critique. It is a reminder to us that we are the 99% and the mainstream, and we have to really make our voices heard. As I was saying, if journalism then is this rough draft of history, then we are really in for a rude awakening, because these rough drafts are not always accurate. And whether it's because journalistic deadlines or ignorance of an issue or fear of offending a source or an advertiser or an owner of a major media outlet, there's many possible reasons that rough drafts are not always accurate, for they tend to become narratives and maintenance of the established order rather than factually inclusive reports about a complex and diverse world. In the United States, culturally conditioned assumptions like exceptionalism, mythic narratives of exceptionalism, or the belief in the country's unique moral mission are very powerful and pervasive, and they further bolster these establishment views, which in turn maintain order and reinforce hierarchy and oppression. They represent an underlying bias. This is what America is and is not. This is what America does and does not do. Thus, historical mythic narratives are a significant part of educational and media institutions in the United States, and they frame our perception. Let's go back to William Casey's quote from the CIA. Much of the information we receive comes from mass media and institutions of education, all of which are subject to some degree of government oversight and control, as well as clearly from the private sector. The leading public institutions of our society, the government, the mass media, the educational institutions, are increasingly influenced or outright owned by extremely, extremely wealthy transnational corporations that have vested interests in returns on venture capital, not democracy, and have very little interest in factual reality or truth. These interests adhere to the bottom line first and foremost, and these are the reasons we need to call them out for that bias. Michael Parenti has talked also about the stacked deck of history as a political scientist. He argues that history is not just what historians say it is, but what government agencies, corporate publishing conglomerates, chain store distributors, mass media pundits, editors, reviewers, and other ideological gatekeepers want to put into circulation. Not surprisingly, the deck is stacked in favor of those who deal the cards. One must then ask, how might those dealing the cards influence the reporting of news? One way is by framing or controlling what is considered legitimate information and what is not, i.e. what makes the news and what's on the test in school, solely on the basis of what the dealers say it is without question. Any official account of the past not only impact perception in the present, but also consistently crowd out vernacular views, often rendering them obscure and illegitimate, thus part of a pile of unhistory. George Orwell wrote about the unperson, the person that did not conform to the state propaganda and rule. The unhistory is the history that defies the dominant state corporatist narrative. The events of 9/11 fit into that category. There are many facts of 9/11 that defy the official narrative, which is why they find themselves on the margins or the outside of even allegedly intellectual culture. What we need to do as citizens of a purportedly free society is simply demand that those narratives are present, and events like this remind us that they are part of the public sphere. I think this is a very, very important thing that we all collectively need to remember. Uncritical acceptance of any official narrative is the result of conventional education, past reporting. This can all shade interpretations of the present. Noam Chomsky also has referred to this as the necessary illusions of our democracy. And I'm well aware that people in 9/11 research circles have their issues with people like Chomsky or Amy Goodman or Michael Parenti or other figures on the left. And oft it's because some of characters on the left have been loath to apply their own standards of critical judgment to themselves when addressing 9/11 issues. We're here to politely remind people, as George Carlin once said, let's not have a double standard here. One standard will do just fine. Cheers to George. In manipulating historical records as they unfold, censorship occurs at the moment of inception and continues to shape and frame public perceptions in ways that distract attention from cause and effect analysis of the events, often by concealing the power elite's motives and the role these play in political and economic matters. And in the introduction of our new book, Censored 2013, this issue of false consciousness is addressed by Nafis Mossadegh Ahmed, who refers to this again, and it's promoted as propaganda and maintenance of the powerful, and he has written several books on that, including The War on Truth and The War on Freedom. Many of you are probably aware of Nafis's work, and if not, I would urge you to look at them. I'd like to close by using a couple examples that discuss this narrative perception of history. By pointing out what's now at the front page of ProjectCensored.org, a study that I did with Laurel Krauss, who is, some of you may recognize her name, the sister of her slain sister, Allison Krauss, at the Kent State shootings, the Kent State massacre of May 1970. And the reason I bring this article up, it's part of our 2013 censored book, but this is a classic example of how we're working to uncensor the unhistories of our culture, because the protesters at Kent State University and the people that were shot, 4 killed, 9 wounded, were murdered by the state. And I don't mean that glibly. I mean that new evidence that has been shown by forensic experts and even championed by Dennis Kucinich in Congress and then sent to the Department of Justice, which after a year of ignoring these calls for a new investigation on the Kent State shootings, ignored all the new evidence, recited the old evidence, and said there wasn't any cause to open a new case, even though it's been shown that FBI provocateurs working as part of the COINTEL program were there firing shots. They were the shots that allegedly were claimed to be sniper shots, and there are audio voice footage that has been decoded that is someone giving an order for the National Guard to actually fire on unarmed people at the Kent State campus. And the reason that that's poignant isn't just because of the radical injustices that these people have endured for 4 decades. It's because we see the same things happening today with the Occupy movement. We see the same repeated demonization of dissidents and protesters and radical justifications by the state for violence. I know Ann Coulter is an extreme example, but she has cited Kent State as a warning to Occupy, saying that we should kill more of these people, essentially, so that they go away. Now, that's pretty radical, and the state does operate in radical ways at times. But there are also other means by which, throughout history, that the state has operated to condemn, unpopularize, or dissuade people from investigating factual evidence. And through the 1960s, on the run-up to the Kent State shootings, the Central Intelligence Agency helped develop and draft memos that coined the term conspiracy theorist to label Edward J. Epstein about his critiques of the Warren Commission report and the J.F. Kennedy assassination, where they urged people in the media through their Operation Mockingbird programs, as they played their mighty Wurlitzer, to twist, distort, attack anyone that would suggest there were problems with this official narrative of JFK. They did the same types of things with the Kent State shootings. They've done the same things with October Surprise. They've done the same things with the Oklahoma City bombings. They've done the same things with 9/11. They've done the same things with WMD. They've done the same things with election fraud. They've done the same things. Does this get repetitive yet? Is there a pattern afoot? I would submit to you, again, back to our issues of language, that we really need to think about how we say what we say. We need to very clearly focus on the machinations of power in our society and how they help mold, control, and suppress freedom, specifically through dissent of those who wish to seek the truth about what really goes on in their society so they can make the world the beautiful place that it really can be. As Aldous Huxley once wrote, the facts do not cease to exist simply because they are ignored. And we're here to unignore them. With that, I would like to introduce to you the next speaker who will be talking a lot about the people I was talking around, the transnational corporate class, the ruling 1%. I would like to introduce to you the author of 16 books, towering figure of activism, and someone that really is energized with the human spirit, and someone that is also a dear, dear friend of mine, Dr. Peter Phillips.
Well, we certainly, Media Freedom Foundation, certainly hit a home run when we asked Mickey Huff to be director of Project Censored, and he accepted 2 years ago. And his doing that has allowed me to get back to some of my original interests in research, and that's the power elite. And I'm particularly interested in the transnational ruling class and their crimes against democracy. And this fits right into why we're all here today. I want to address the world's 1% power elite and to what extent they operate in unison for their private gains over the benefits of the rest of us. And are they capable of committing state crimes against democracy? The Occupy movement has developed a mantra that addresses the great inequality of wealth and power between the world's wealthiest 1% and the rest of us, the other 99. Foremost among the early works on the idea of interconnected 1% in global capitalism was Leslie Sklar's work in 2001, The Transnational Capitalist Class. Sklar believed that globalization was moving transnational corporations into broader international roles, whereby these corporations' states of origin became less important than international agreements developed through the World Trade Organization and other international institutions. Emerging from these multinational corporations is a transnational capitalist class whose loyalties and interests, while still rooted in their corporations, are increasingly international in scope. Estimates are the total world's wealth is worth close to $200 trillion, with the U.S. and Europe holding approximately 63% of this wealth. An adult requires around $600,000 to be a member of the top 1%. That's $600,000 in assets. As of 2010, the top 1% of the wealthiest people in the world had hidden away between $21 to $32 trillion in secret tax-exempt bank accounts spread all over the world. This was a recent BBC report. The wealthiest 1% of the world's population represent approximately 40 million adults. These 40 million people are the richest segment of the first-tier populations in the core countries and intermittently in other regions throughout the world. Most of this 1% has professional jobs with security and tenure working for or associated with established institutions. Approximately 10 million individuals of this 1% have assets in excess of $1 million, and approximately 100,000 have financial assets worth over $30 million, and it's about 1,000 or so that are billionaires. Now, immediately below this 1%, in the first tier, are working people with regular employment in various corporations, governments, cell phone businesses, and institutions all over the world. This first tier of working people constitutes 30-40% of the industrialized countries and about 30-20% in the underdeveloped countries. Throughout the world, there is a second tier of global workers representing growing armies of casual labor. These are the global factory workers, street workers, day laborers who are intermittently employed with increasingly less support from government and social welfare organizations. These workers, mostly constituted in the mega cities, make up 30-40% of the workers in the industrialized countries, including the U.S., and some 20% in the peripheral countries. This leaves a third tier of destitute people worldwide, ranging from 30% in the core to fully 50% in the rest of the world, who have extremely limited income opportunities and struggle to survive on just a few dollars a day. These are 2.5 billion people who live on less than $2 a day. They die by the tens of thousands every day from malnutrition, easily curable diseases, and most have probably never even heard a dial tone. The number of unnecessary deaths has exceeded 300 million people in the last 40 years. Farmers grow enough food, we just don't distribute it well. So addressing the power of the global 1%, those in charge of food distribution, those in charge of governments, and identifying who they are, what their goals are really life and death questions. Now, it's important to understand how wealth is created and how it becomes concentrated. Historically, wealth has been captured, stolen, and concentrated by conquest by various powerful entities. One need only look at Spain's appropriation of the wealth of the Aztec and Inca empires in the early 16th century for a historical example of this process. The histories of the Roman and British empires are also filled with examples of wealth stolen. Once acquired, wealth can be used to establish means of production, establish cities, and build permanent institutions. But the means of production, like the early British cotton mills, were exploiting workers' labor power to produce goods whose exchange value was greater than the cost of labor. This process was analyzed by Karl Marx in Kapital. A human being is able to produce a product that has a certain value, and organized business hires the workers who are paid below the value of their labor. The result is the creation of what Marx called surplus value, over and above the cost of labor. The creation of surplus value allows those who own the means of production to concentrate capital even more. In addition, concentrated capital accelerates the exploitation of natural resources by private entrepreneurs, by mining and oil companies, whereby the value of the extracted resources far exceeds the cost of removal. It is through exploitation of natural resources that wealth is concentrated even further. This is a transfer of the common heritage of all living beings, the world mineral resources, to the coffers of the global 1%. So what happens to all this surplus money? Today, many firms operate primarily as investment organizations, managing capital and investing in other companies. These firms often do not actually make anything except money, and they are keen to prevent interference with return on capital by taxation, regulations, governmental interventions anywhere in the world. That's what they see it. They want no government interference. They want the free flow of capital worldwide. Now, a 2011 study at the University of Zurich, researched by three researchers there at the Swiss Federal Institute, reports that a small group of companies, mainly banks, wield huge power in the global economy. The study looked at all 43,000 transnational corporations and the web of ownership between them. The research created a map of 1,300 companies at the heart of the global economy. The study found that the 143 companies formed a super entity within this map, controlling some 40% of the world's wealth. The top 25 of these super entities are mostly banks and investment firms. So these are some examples, and this is when we start talking about the 1%, the kind of education that we all need. Number two in this list is Capital Group Companies, privately held, based in Los Angeles, manages $1 trillion in assets. Number three is FMR, one of the world's largest mutual funds, managing $1.5 trillion in assets, serving more than 20 million individuals. Number four is AXA, manages $1.5 trillion in assets, serving 101 million clients. Number five is State Street Corporation, out of Boston, with assets in management of $1.9 trillion. Number six is J.P. Morgan, 2011 assets, $2.3 trillion. Their board of directors sits on Boeing, NBC, Universal, Comcast, Honeywell, Exxon. Next is Vanguard, number seven, assets, $1.3 trillion. Then there's USB, AIG, assets, $620 billion. Number nine is Merrill Lynch, assets of $2.3 trillion. Their directors sit on Bank of America, New York Stock Exchange, Credit Suisse, MedLife, Citibank, USB, Carlyle, Verizon, Fluor, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs. These are networks of power, people who know each other on the corporate boards of the world. Now, the number one most connected corporation in the world is Barclays. Members of the board of Barclays are on the boards of Abis, the South African banking company, Visa in Europe, British Broadcasting, PricewaterhouseCoopers, U.S. Banking, Audit Practice, Pricewaterhouse, Morgan Stanley, ILA, the Italian Energy Group, Telecom Italia, Fidelity International, Rockefeller Group, Goldman Sachs, Bank of England, S.B. Miller, Barrett Gold, McGraw-Hill, and Schweppes. Now, that's just one bank. Now, tied closely to Barclays is the largest assets management firm in the world. It's called BlackRock, Inc., and it has over 10,000 employees based in New York, investment teams in 27 countries. Their clients include corporate, public unions, pension funds, government, insurance companies, third-party mutuals, endowments, foundations. They go on and on. BlackRock controls $3.68 trillion in equity funds. That's a massive amount of money. BlackRock is one of the most concentrated power networks in the global 1%. The 18 members of the board of directors are connected to a significant part of the world's core financial assets. Their decisions can change empires, destroy currencies, impoverish millions. Some of the top financial giants of the world are connected by interlocking boards of directors at BlackRock, including Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, PNC Bank, Barclays, Swiss Reinsurance, American AIG, Arab Fund for Economic Development, Morgan Chase, and Morgan Stanley. That's in a concentrated, the most wealthy company in the world. BlackRock alone, their board has links to seven of the top 25 most interconnected corporations in the Swiss study. BlackRock's 18 board members control and influence tens of trillions of dollars of wealth in the world and represent a core of the super-connected financial elite. What's interesting for our purposes is we know that Barclays was a key insider in the Libor scandal, whereby traders and banks worldwide colluded to manipulate the Libor interest rates covering 10 global currencies in 2008, costing pension funds and other investors hundreds of billions of dollars. This was outright theft. The government is suing Barclays for $126 million, but nobody's going to jail over this. Corporate elites are interconnected through direct board connections with major multinational corporations, policy groups, media organizations, and other academic and nonprofit institutions. These interlock relationships reoccur across the top interconnected companies and in a powerful network who share an interest in preserving their elite domination, and they are generally immune from criminal prosecution. Now, if a transnational corporate board meets on a regular basis to encourage the maximization of profit and the long-term viability of the firm's business plans, if they arrange for payments to government officials, conduct activities that undermine labor organizations, seek to manipulate the price of commodities and gold, engage in insider trading, they are in fact forming conspiratorial alliances inside these board of director rooms. Crimes are committed every day in these boardrooms around the world. Now, even deeper inside this 1% is what David Rykoff called the superclass. Rykoff was the former managing director of Kissinger Associates, says that the superclass constitutes about 1/1,000th of 1% of the world's population, comprising 6,000 to 7,000 people. These are the Davos-attending, Gulfstream, private jet-flying, money-encrusted, mega-corporation, interlocked, policy-planning elites of the world. People who at the absolute peak of power, they are 99% male, predominantly white, mostly from North America and Europe, and they're the people setting the agendas of the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberger Group, and meet at Davos, the G8, the G20, NATO, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization. They run these places. The billionaires in the global 1% are similar to colonial plantation owners. They know they are a small minority with vast resources and power, yet they must continually worry about the unruly exploited masses rising in rebellion. As a result, the class insecurities, the superclass works to protect the structure of concentrated wealth. Protection of capital is the prime reason that NATO now accounts for 85% of the world's defense spending, and the U.S. spending more on military than the rest of the world combined. Would world elites commit SCADs, state crimes against democracy? Absolutely. Their private and public police forces do it every day. It's not just who that was directly behind 9/11 or who killed Kennedy. It is a recognition that when power lies in the world and the absolute control of power allows the transnational corporate class to dominate and set the agendas. NATO is quickly becoming the police force of the transnational corporate class. It has become clear that superclass uses NATO for global security. This is part of an expanding strategy of the U.S.-NATO domination of the world, whereby the U.S.-NATO military-industrial media empire operates in service to the transnational corporate class for the protection of international capital everywhere in the world. So it's a world of financial institutions run amok, where the answer to bankruptcy is to print more money through quantitative easing, with trillions of new inflation-producing dollars. It's a world of permanent war, whereby spending for destruction requires more spending to rebuild, a cycle that profits the transnational corporations and the global networks of economic power. It is a world of drone killings, extrajudicial assassinations, death, and destruction at home and abroad. Occupy and other truth-telling movements like 9/11 are exactly what the superclass fears the most. Global economic movements that expose their agenda. So everybody, let's keep it up. We have a world to win.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
to the beginning of the 27th year of Radio Curious. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. This edition is devoted to the pending Senate hearings and possible confirmation of Rex Tillerson as the next United States Secretary of State. Tillerson, the ExxonMobil oil company chief executive officer, was chosen by Donald Trump to head the State Department. He has a long history in the Russian oil business, as well as having an alleged personal friendship with Vladimir Putin, the Russian president. Our guest is Andrew Kramer, who has been a reporter for the New York Times at its Moscow, Russia bureau for the past 10 years. Kramer shares his reporting on Tillerson's attempts on behalf of Exxon to gain access to the Russian Arctic oil fields, as well as Tillerson's personal connections to Vladimir Putin. In addition, Kramer investigated and revealed the activities of Paul Manafort in Russia, who, within a week after those reports became public, resigned as Donald Trump's campaign manager. When Andrew Kramer and I visited from the New York Times bureau in Moscow by telephone on December 29, 2016, we began with his description of Tillerson's history in Russia.
Rex Tillerson has a long history in Russia, and the arc of his career here in a large part traces some of the key developments in Russia over that same 25-year period, because Rex Tillerson was involved in Russia since soon after the breakup of communism. As an executive at Exxon, he was overseeing Exxon's move into Russia, into this vast, newly opened territory for the oil industry. His first venture in Russia was in the Far East, in Sakhalin, for the offshore oil development there. And he met Putin for the first time before Putin was even president of Russia during a visit by Mr. Putin to this oil platform off the eastern coast of Siberia. Obviously, his importance rose when he became president, and Tillerson's relationship with Mr. Putin became very important as Exxon expanded its operations in Russia. The largest step for them came in 2011 when they signed a deal to develop oil resources off of Russia's northern coast in the Arctic Ocean. And then this deepened the tie between Exxon and the Russian government right up until sanctions were imposed in 2014. Tillerson had opposed them.
The reason for those sanctions?
Well, the sanctions were imposed because of Russia's intervention in Ukraine. They came in three phases. The first phase was for annexing the Crimea Peninsula, and then a more intensive and damaging phase of sanctions came in the summer of 2014 after the United States government said Russia had shot down a civilian airliner over Ukraine and was sending its military across the border into eastern Ukraine. And these were the sanctions that really hit Exxon's business hard.
Which Tillerson obviously opposed.
That's right. He doesn't come out directly against sanctions. The statements were cautious. Exxon's actions were actually speaking louder than their statements.
What were those sanctions?
The sanctions were what were called sectoral sanctions, and they restricted loans to Russian companies to 3 months, so they could only American companies could only provide short-term credit to the Russian state bank, Sberbank, and the Russian oil company, Rosneft, and others. And the other portion of them were industry sanctions that limited the transfer of technology to Russia. And this was specifically Arctic offshore drilling technology and shale oil technology.
And you mentioned a moment ago that Exxon's actions spoke louder than their statements. What were their actions?
Well, the sanctions caught Exxon at a very delicate moment because after years of preparation in the summer of 2014, Exxon was sending an exploratory drilling rig into the Russian sector of the Arctic to test the thesis that there was oil in this area. It was an extraordinarily expensive venture. Just this one well would cost close to $700 million. And this entire venture coincided with the escalation of the war in eastern Ukraine. so that the rig, which was initially based in Norway, was still in port when the airliner was shot down, the Malaysian airline Flight 17 over eastern Ukraine. This was a horrendous event, which I covered in Ukraine, and only a few days later, the Exxon, in spite of this and the likelihood that there would be repercussions in the form of sanctions, Exxon sent its rig into the Arctic.
What were Exxon's statements contrary to their actions?
Well, the statements, as I said, were very cautious. The company's stated position on sanctions was not opposition, but rather opposition to sanctions that would exceed those of the European Union. And as I mentioned, Tillerson, in comments, made clear he was opposed to sanctions, but only spoke of them several times in 2014. At the same time, they were pressing ahead with this drilling venture that would greatly help the Russian oil industry.
An economic desire on Exxon's part to have access to greater oil fields in the Russian Arctic.
That's right. The profit motive was clear for Exxon, but the story behind it is also the story of U.S. relations with Russia in recent years, because this whole process began under the Obama administration's reset with Russia, in which the Obama administration encouraged companies like Exxon to become involved. The idea would be there would be a profit motive on both sides to have a stable relationship, that Russian oil companies would benefit, American oil companies would benefit, and as a result, the governments would behave better. So these sorts of deals were encouraged up until 2014.
And they were discouraged today, December 29th, 2016, when President Obama issued further sanctions against Russia for the involvement that he alleges occurred with regard to the election here, resulting in Trump being the president-elect. Can you address those?
Well, sure. This is just another indication that our new Secretary of State, Tillerson, if he's approved by the Senate, is going to be walking into a real beehive of issues in Russia. He's opposed to sanctions, but the new sanctions were imposed for electoral meddling, and the Central Intelligence Agency has determined that the goal of Russia's hacking campaign during the election was to help Donald Trump get elected. So it's a very delicate issue for Trump, and it will be a delicate issue for his new Secretary of State in responding to Russia. He'll be faced with the choice of lifting these sanctions, which were largely symbolic in that they target the Russia's two main intelligence agencies, the Federal Security Service and the main intelligence directive of the Russian military. These are not organizations that obviously do business or have a lot of people traveling to the United States or having their money kept in American banks. Nonetheless, Tillerson will have to decide whether to lift these sanctions, obviously together with the Trump White House, or to leave them in place, which is something of an embarrassment if the sanctions were imposed for an action which was intended to get Trump elected.
Well, that would also address, would it not, the connection between Tillerson and Exxon that would benefit if the sanctions were lifted?
That's right. That would be the Ukraine-related sanctions. And there's talk, and this was brought up in an interview with Henry Kissinger recently, that Trump might consider, or certainly the Russians would be interested in, a new sphere of influences deal in Europe, where the U.S. would back off from Ukraine and perhaps Georgia and allow Russia to have sway in these areas in exchange for perhaps a promise of good behavior in the future and a lessening of the ongoing violence in eastern Ukraine. And then sanctions would be lifted with the added bonus, the sort of icing on the cake here being a very profitable business opportunity for Exxon.
What likelihood do you see of that occurring?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, we've been through an interesting year politically. Nobody expected voters in England to vote for Brexit, even for Donald Trump to be elected. So now there's talk that it might be impossible to have a new sphere of influences deal. I just had an interview today with a U.S. senator on this topic who was saying that the Congress would never accept a sphere of influences deal with Russia, a sort of new Yalta. But it's clearly something that the Russians would want and something that Trump, as a deal-cutting businessman, might consider.
We're visiting with Andrew Kramer, a New York Times reporter based in the Times Moscow Bureau. This is Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Andrew, on December 21st of this year in the Times, you wrote that Mr. Tillerson's personal relationships with Putin and Sechin are expected to undergo microscopic scrutiny during the upcoming Senate confirmation hearings. Can you elaborate on that?
In addition to being acquainted with Vladimir Putin, Tillerson has done business with and worked for an extended period with Igor Sechin, one of Putin's right-hand men, also a former intelligence officer who's now head of the Russian state oil company. Tillerson obviously concluded the deals, the Exxon deals with Sechin, and the two call each other friends. So that's a relationship which will be carefully reviewed. I mean, I don't know how many in Congress would want our Secretary of State to be considered a friend of a close ally of Putin, and indeed of Putin himself, who's given Tillerson an award for friendship. So this long relationship with the senior leadership in Russia, which was centered on oil and gas and profit, rather than some of the more thorny issues of politics and even of war and human rights in Eastern Europe, is something that is likely to come up during his confirmation hearings.
What access or input might you personally have into those hearings? You mentioned that just before you and I began our visit today, you were in touch with a member of the United States Senate.
Well, the short answer is probably none. Sometimes the Congress references newspaper articles for the record, and a congressman will stand up and enter a newspaper article for the record. Other times, articles can prompt hearings. This has happened rarely in my career working overseas, but it did happen once with oil deals in Iraq. I think in the Tillerson hearings, there will be obviously reams of information that the Congress has access to. But New York Times articles are also read.
Andrew Kramer, in August of this year, during the time that Paul Manafort was Donald Trump's campaign manager, you did some stories about his connections with people in Russia. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was a complicated investigation, but the idea behind it was that his campaign manager, Trump's campaign manager at the time, Paul Manafort, had worked for years in Ukraine as an advisor to an authoritarian president who was also an ally of the Russians. And this work was largely shrouded in secrecy. But there had been a revolution in Ukraine in 2014. So many of the documents of the old government were coming into public view through various means. Some were discovered, for example, in the former president's yacht harbor the day after he fled his palace on the outskirts of Kiev, and they were fished out of the water and dried out and examined. Others were found in a sauna of a senior official, and still others were found in a building of his political party that was burning down during the revolution. They were taken out and examined. So I knew that at least some papers regarding Paul Manafort's work had come out during the revolution, and I wrote a small story about it at the time. But once he was named chairman of the Trump campaign, we decided to go back and take another look at this issue and see if there might be more, which led to an investigation that determined he had received under-the-table payments in Ukraine totaling about $12.7 million. And this was revealed in an article that came out in August, and within a week he had resigned as campaign manager.
How do you think that issue dovetails into what we spoke of earlier concerning Tillerson and Exxon, and Tillerson potentially being the new Secretary of State?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about Trump's ties to Russia and what they mean, and there's not a clear answer to it, honestly. His own business dealings have been limited, so far as we know. He sold some property to Russian oligarchs. He's been to Russia to host a beauty pageant. But many of his advisors and senior aides have a position which is really a head-scratcher for Republicans, which is a desire to have close relationships with a close relationship with Russia, even as Russia veers into a more authoritarian and anti-Western stance in its policies. We've seen this consistently through the campaign and into the transition period. So it's almost as if, you know, the world's been turned upside down. You have Democrats arguing for a more aggressive stance toward Russia, and the Republican Trump administration supporting exactly the opposite. There are business interests perhaps behind this, as we mentioned with Exxon, and there may be personal histories, as with Paul Manafort, who had a long history of working in Ukraine for a pro-Russian administration there. And we'll see how this plays out. What exactly this signifies? Some have suggested this is a reverse Kissinger. That what Trump intends to do is to befriend Russia and turn against China, much as Kissinger in the 1970s befriended China as a way to weaken Russia. If there is a strategy behind it, it's hard to tell with Trump.
You have any insight into that beyond what you just said?
I don't. I don't cover the U.S. side of the transition, and it's a bit of guesswork whether, for example, his phone call to the president of Taiwan, which broke with U.S. policy on China, was carefully thought out or just the result of lack of preparation, that it was an off-the-cuff decision. And sometimes it seems that his comments are not fully thought out. For example, on the hacking sanctions, he responded to the likely sanctions yesterday by saying that computers have made our lives easier but also complicated them. It's a very vague and hard to understand response to the idea that Russia had interfered in the election to help him comment on the effect of technology on our lives in that way. I thought I might go over a bit, if we're talking about Tillerson, our next Secretary of State, if he's confirmed, a little bit about this period in summer of 2014, when I was working in Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine, and intensively covering the conflict there. On July 17th of that year, there was really an awful event where a civilian airplane, Malaysia Airlines 17, Flight 17, was shot down over eastern Ukraine. And the wreckage landed in the middle of a battlefield. So you had the armies literally fighting over the scattered wreckage of this Boeing 777 airplane. And the remains of those who were on it, are really one of the more gruesome things that have happened in recent years in this part of the world. And these are the kind of difficult, painful, and complicated issues which Tillerson doesn't have experience with based on his dealings with Russia from the point of view of the energy relationship. I think there are two sides of the coin with Russia. One, a lot of opportunity, obviously, to improve relations. And then this other side, which was the risk of Russian expansion and aggression in Eastern Europe, which is not abstract at all.
What do you see as coming from that risk? Where do you think it may lead?
I think the stated goal of the Russians is to restore a sphere of influence, to restore, if not the Soviet Union, a version of the Russian Empire. They think that Ukraine and parts of Eastern Europe are historically areas that should be under Moscow's control. And I think that using various means, which could well lead to a war in Central Europe, that influence will be restored if there's not a contrary move from the West to check it.
And what would you anticipate the breadth of that contrary move to be to succeed in checking it?
Well, that's really the $64,000 question, or $64,000 worth of sanctions. It could be economic pressure, but also would most likely have to include a very clearly stated Western concept of what Eastern Europe should be, and a lack of security guarantees in Eastern Europe have been the causes of two world wars. Obviously, the First World War began in the Balkans, and then the Second World War over the division of Eastern Europe between the Soviet Union and Germany in 1939, partly because the treaty that ended the First World War did not offer these security guarantees for Eastern Europe. NATO was supposed to address this problem. Obviously, it probably should have been done differently to not have a triumphalist element after the end of the Cold War that we were moving into Eastern Europe as the victors. But nonetheless, Trump's statements about NATO have really opened a lot of questions about Western commitments to the borders in Eastern Europe. And this is not going to go unnoticed in Russia. So I think that that's the real risk, is that we'll have a mushy understanding of where the lines should be drawn in Eastern Europe, which could invite a war.
So then bringing this back around to Rex Tillerson, what is your opinion?
It's said that Tillerson is a very tough negotiator and that he did well negotiating for his company in Russia. And it could well be that he would be a good negotiator for the United States. On the other hand, the depth of his experience extends only to the depth of oil wells and not to the other concerns, human rights and the security questions in Central Europe. So I would not want to venture a guess on how he'll handle this problem.
Tell us, Andrew Kramer, the area which you do cover as one of the New York Times reporters based in Moscow.
Well, very honestly, it's a fabulous job. It's almost a Disneyland for a reporter in this part of the world, and particularly working out of this bureau. We cover everything from the Baltic states, which are a little corner of Europe, down to Central Asia and Tajikistan, which borders on Afghanistan, has many of the same issues there with terrorism and instability. Obviously, Ukraine is part of the beat, and it's been a big issue in the last 3 years. It's a position which involves conflict reporting, war reporting, but also business coverage. And if you want it, there's plenty of work to be done on the arts and culture in Russia. Very rich tradition and a lot going on in those spheres as well.
Who provides the direction to you on the areas which you investigate?
In the Times, it varies a bit depending on where a reporter is working, but most of the story ideas are generated by reporters and pitched to editors who then gauge their interest in the idea and move forward with it. Sometimes on larger projects, there's collaboration between editors and reporters beforehand, and then a story is put together. But by and large, the coverage is driven out of our bureau here in Moscow with reading of the Russian press, talking to Russians, talking to people who live in this part of the world about the issues that are important to them, and then putting that together into narratives, which can be written as newspaper stories.
What is the response of the person on the street to the new regime that will be taking over in the United States on January 20th, 2017?
Well, in conversations that I've had, the usual response is Russians are pleased that relations between our countries might improve. And here in Russia, Trump has been viewed as a guy who will stop talking down to Russia, who will stop lecturing Russia, and perhaps exhibiting some hypocrisy in preaching about policies that Russia should pursue while violating those principles, as the Russians see it, in America's own foreign policy. So they think there'll be a break with the past. Trump was always considered the pro-Russian candidate. Some people here, based on watching Russian state television, thought that if Hillary Clinton were elected, there would be war with the United States. So people are, by and large, pleased. I think his personality reminds Russians of a Russian politician, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, a clownish, jester-like politician who's been around for a long time and is also something of a misogynist and a nationalist and quite a talker as well. So I think there's some similarity there. There's some recognition of this personality type, at least in this part of the world, of the larger-than-life leader. I would say, by and large, there's hope that relations will improve.
Well, Andrew Kramer, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I have some questions about you. And one is, how long have you been based in the Moscow Bureau of the New York Times?
Barry, that's a good question, and it's been a long time. I've been here now for more than 10 years.
May we presume that you have a considerable fluency in Russian?
Yes, I do. I work without an interpreter and read the newspapers, watch the Russian television without any problem.
And tell us a little bit more about yourself. The question that I do ask all my guests at the end of an interview is to describe a eureka or an aha moment in your life that changed your view of your life, of the world, of your future.
Well, it might be a small thing, but when I was a student at UC Santa Cruz, toward the end of my time in Santa Cruz, I had a job writing advertising copy for a newsletter. I think it was mailed to residents or dropped off in grocery stores. I'm not sure how it was distributed, but I was paid $200 for an article, and these were infomercial articles. I wrote one about a Volvo dealership, for example, and it was just a real revelation to me that I could make money by writing, and I never really looked back after that.
Tell us, Andrew, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Well, Barry, I'm looking out the window here in Moscow from my office, and it's pitch black. Obviously, it's night here, and the parking lot outside is covered in snow. It's very cold, and I spent a long time in Russia. So one goal I would have would be to explore another part of the world, maybe even America. So I would certainly want to expand my horizons a bit.
And finally, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
A book that I enjoyed and was written by a mentor of mine, David Hoffman, the former bureau chief of the Washington Post in Moscow, is called The Dead Hand. And it's a story about the Russian nuclear weapons program at the end of the Soviet period and into the post-Soviet period. And it's a really chilling story about nuclear weapons, told in a very gripping manner. With some details that many people might not know. For example, the Russian government had developed a so-called dead hand weapon, where if the leader were killed, the proverbial twitching fingers of the dead leader would set off nuclear war. In other words, there was a mechanism to launch if there was no leadership. The book it covers this topic and many others, but is also a very good read about nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons policy. Maybe that sounds a little bit grim, but the storyline is very well put together. The Dead Hand by David Hoffman.
Andrew Kramer, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Andrew Kramer has been a reporter for the New York Times Moscow Bureau for the past 10 years. He has reported on the business and personal connections of ExxonMobil Chief Executive Officer Rex Tillerson in Russia. Tillerson is Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of State. The Senate hearings to confirm his appointment as Secretary of State will begin this winter. The book Andrew Kramer recommends is The Dead Hand, the untold story of the Cold War arms race and its dangerous legacy, by David Hoffman. This program was recorded on December 29, 2016. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website. They're free for anyone to enjoy, download, and broadcast as you wish. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters about our programming and look forward to hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The snail mail is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah. That's UKIAH, California. 95482. And the phone is 707-462-6541. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out. We are the only minority group that you can join overnight.
From Overnight Productions.
In the twinkling of an eye, in fact.
Happy 2017 and welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Lucia Chappell. Our news wrap crew took some time off for the holidays, but they'll return next week.
Maybe we could all use a break from the news, Lucia.
So let's celebrate the new year and fortify ourselves for the challenges ahead with a few rousing queer anthems.
Brothers and sisters, when the
Stand beside the one you love.
Stand up for who you are, what you believe.
I wish they knew the love I always feel, feeling of you next to me.
And if you hear those words of hate, just know
love knows no color or gender. Love will be yourself. Have you once said, burst down those closet doors once and for all? Stand up.
You're alone, and the world throws out a lot of hate.
It's not the end. You're not out there on your own. There's still so much in life to celebrate.
Just look up.
Yourself, and you will find the way.
Don't give up.
songs to be sung. There are beautiful sunsets and battles of one.
There's love to be found if you just stick around.
Don't give up, your life has just begun. It gets better, better, better. Oh, just get up, get up, get up. Oh, just give it another way. It gets better, better, better. The world gets lighter, lighter, lighter. We are lighter, lighter, lighter. Oh, just live to see that day. It gets better, better, better. The pain will let up, let up, let up. If you fall, just get up, get up, get up.
My mother knew I wasn't straight. She didn't understand, but she had so much to say. She sat me on the couch, looked me straight in my face, and said, "You'll burn in hell or probably die of AIDS." It's funny now, but at 13, it was pain to be almost sure of who you are and have it ripped away. And I'm sorry if it's too real for some of you to fathom, but hate for who you love is not exactly what you'd imagine. And I guess it was disastrous, cause everything that happened afterwards was just madness. Locked away for 2 years to keep me on the inside, because she'd rather see a part of me die than me thrive. And it's tougher when it's something you can't deny, and ignorance teaches us it's something that you decide. You're driven by your choices, an optical illusion. Here's to understanding that it's not always confusion.
And I can't change, even if I tried, even if I wanted to.
And my lay sisters everywhere in the struggle. Always love from your heart, never love from society. The hate is too much, all in the name of piety. You gain this thing strong, Nigeria, Africa. It's time for new laws, no time for new walls. We come from the same God, cut from the same cord. Share the same pain and share the same skin. The march is still on, but the spirit lives on. It's a bedroom struggle and also a street struggle. Judge less and love more, stand up and stand tall. Talk tough for talk more. We gon' not be loved more, y'all.
I can't change, even if I try.
Shift try,
even if I want to.
I've tried, y'all.
I can't change.
I can't change,
even if I try.
I can't change,
even if I want to.
I will never change.
My love, she keeps me warm.
He keep me warm,
she
y'all.
Keeps me warm.
I tell you, he keep me warm,
she
y'all.
Keeps me warm.
Keep me warm,
she
y'all.
Keeps me warm.
Believe he keep me warm, y'all.
boxed in and labeled before we're ever able to speak who we believe we are.
Love is patient,
or who we dream will become.
Love is kind,
like drum beats forever changing their rhythm.
Love is selfless.
I am living today as someone.
Love is faith.
I have not yet become yesterday.
Love is full of hope.
Love is whoever you are when the stars shine, and whoever you'll be when the sun rises. So here's to being able. Here's to love. Here's to loving just because.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
Everybody's got a pain inside. Imaginary wounds they fight to hide. How can I hate them? When everybody's got a pulse, I dream in a world that wants my soul. It tells me if I hate, I can control. But I don't believe it. I cannot conceive it. 'Cause everybody's got a pulse. I am human.
I am love, and my heart beats with my blood. Love will always win underneath the skin. Everybody's got a pulse. Once again I hang my head to cry. I can't find a reason why they died. We will find the answer blowing in the wind. But everybody's got a pulse. I am human, I am love, and my heart beats with my blood. Love will always win underneath the skin. Everybody's got a pulse. Who you gonna hate now when there's no one left but you? Who are you gonna gun down if you can't kill the truth that's inside of us? It's inside our blood. It's inside our pulse. I am human, I am love, and my heart beats in my blood. Love will always win underneath the skin. Everybody's got a pulse.
Everybody's got a pulse.
I am human, I am love, and my heart beats in my blood. Love will always win underneath the skin. Everybody's got a pulse. I am human, I am love, and my heart beats in my blood. Love will always win underneath the skin. Everybody's got a pulse. Everybody's got a pulse.
find us, a way to find us, a way to see.
Tuning into this special Music Will Get Us Through It edition of This Way Out, starring Robbie Siffre, The L Project, Broadway Sings for the Trevor Project, Angel Hayes, Art Attack,
Meg Hinches, Melissa Etheridge, and Margie Adam. As always, Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music.
This Way Out thanks our individual listener donors who make this program possible.
Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA.
For everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Lucia Chappelle. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org.
And on more than 200 local stations around the world.
Including this community radio station.
We shall grow more. We shall grow more. We shall grow more. We shall grow more. We shall grow.
Stay tuned.
Doing your
Happy New Year.
Believe me.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the 1970s, after years of struggle by African-American families to desegregate schools in northern cities, the court stepped in and ordered the transfer of black and white students between schools, what has become known as busing. But the crisis of school segregation was overshadowed by the so-called crisis of busing, which the media presented through the lens of the white families opposing it. Yet even at its peak in the 1970s, court-ordered busing applied to only 5% of public school students, something which Matthew Delmont explores in his book, Why Busing Failed: Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation, published by the University of California Press. He teaches history at Arizona State University and joins me now. Matthew, in the media coverage of the time, and in most of the histories that have come down to us, busing has been portrayed as the rock against which the Northern civil rights movement foundered. Why do you argue, then, that busing is a red herring?
So I think the problem is that we tend to start the story of busing in the 1970s in Boston. But in fact, you have busing show up as an issue almost two decades earlier. So just after the Brown versus Board decision, you have civil rights activists in places like New York and other northern cities pushing their school officials to address northern school segregation. So when we start the story in the 1970s, we miss the fact that there's organized civil rights activism across the North that's calling attention to these issues. But we also miss the fact that there was organized resistance to civil rights and organized resistance to school segregation that starts in the 1950s in the North that uses the language of busing as a way to motivate and mobilize against school segregation. So by the late 1950s, you have white mothers in New York marching and using the language of busing to say that they don't want their kids sent to different schools or don't want any other black or Puerto Rican kids sent to white schools. And you see protests in cities like Boston, Chicago, Detroit by the early 1960s. So this story really starts almost two decades before the 1970s. And if we lose that history, we fail to understand how this language developed and why it resonated so powerfully with people who were against school segregation in the North.
Well, let's talk about that broader context historically. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus Board of Education that racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. How did patterns of school segregation differ in the North and the West than in the South?
The mechanisms by which schools became segregated outside of the South were more subtle. So the Brown versus Board decision only applied to schools in the South. And what they had there was what was called de jure segregation, so segregation by law, where it was officially the case where you had white schools and black schools. In the North, Midwest, and West, you had percentages that looked quite similar to the South in terms of school segregation, but the mechanisms were different. It was often referred to as de facto segregation, but that's in some ways a misnomer because that implies that it was innocent in some way. And in fact, it wasn't innocent at all, that you had neighborhoods that were created based on segregated housing policies, segregated mortgage lending policies and public housing policies. And then you had school district lines, the zoning lines that followed those residential segregation patterns and also in some cases exacerbated those housing patterns. But those were very difficult for civil rights activists to prove because the northern school boards would consistently deny that they were intentionally taking steps to segregate their schools. So as a result, it was visible to anyone who looked that schools in Los Angeles, schools in Chicago, schools in New York were incredibly segregated. But it was very difficult to bring those cases to courts to be able to have them addressed.
So you're saying that this notion of de facto segregation ultimately proved to be a problem because it projected the idea that people of different races chose to live apart or study apart, hence, and that public policy, in effect, was not the culprit.
Exactly. Initially, that language of de facto is advocated by civil rights activists and lawyers as a way to put more pressure on the South. So they see the South as a more clear-cut case that they can bring to the Supreme Court and win that case. And so they're initially pushing for a different treatment of how they view segregation in the South versus in the North. What ends up happening, though, is that language gets taken up, this language of de facto gets taken up by northern politicians, northern parents, northern school officials as a way to say, you know, what we have going on here, it's innocent. This is just a result of private decisions, of market forces, of where people are choosing to live, and that government has no role in this. Historians have now found in a number of cases all across the country that idea of de facto is a myth, that, in fact, there were a series of both public and private decisions that created segregated neighborhoods and schools all across the country. And it was just incredibly difficult for civil rights activists and lawyers to win those cases. They had to find a tremendous amount of evidence and try to extract that evidence from school officials who are often very reluctant to provide sort of the detailed descriptions of why school zones were drawn the way they were.
So what were the differences in the way the law was applied to segregation in the South and in the North? And perhaps you could explain the concept of racial imbalance, a rather slippery term.
Sure. So after Brown versus Board, I think two things happened. In the South, you have what they call massive resistance. So school boards, politicians refusing to abide by the Supreme Court ruling. So for a good 10 years after 1954, very little actual integration happens in the South. In the North, civil rights activists recognize that this decision only applies to the South, but they're waiting for a similar type of decision to come to their cities because they recognize school segregation is there. For school officials, they're in some ways hoping that that kind of decision doesn't come to their schools. They recognize that there is what they end up calling racial imbalance. So that language of racial imbalance is a euphemism for school segregation because, again, they're looking for ways to describe the conditions of segregation. So the fact that you have schools that are over 90% African-American or schools that are over 90% white, but they want to call it something different than segregation because segregation is what they're going to associate with the South. So they end up choosing this language of racial imbalance.
So to what degree were white children being bused in the North before the court stepped in around desegregation of schools?
Before you have the active protests against busing, you have school buses being used all across the country, and they're doing two things. They're helping to make it possible to have a more modern school district, so you have students being transported to larger high schools. But then at the same time, you have buses often being used to transport white students past closer African-American schools to white schools, and black students passed near white schools to African-American schools. So busing is actually initially used in many cases to perpetuate school segregation. When they start making these both voluntary and court-ordered plans to try to integrate schools using busing, the first attempts at that are usually transporting African-American and Puerto Rican students to all-white schools, and then usually not transporting white children. So some of the first protests I found against busing are taking place in Queens in the late 1950s, for example. And there you had white mothers protesting a policy that was going to send 400 African-American and Puerto Rican students from a school in Brooklyn to a school in Queens. No white children were going to be bused there. It was going to be a one-way busing program, but still it provoked month-long protests among the white community.
So in effect, the rhetoric that was harnessed around busing by white parents, which was that their children were going to be sent out of their neighborhoods, far away, stuck on buses to integrate, in effect, all black schools, and the mantra that they wanted neighborhood schools, this became a real catchphrase, that was actually not even part of the picture in these early protests against busing, that the white students weren't being bused in the first place.
That's exactly right. So a lot of the protests that came out around busing were about a fear about what might happen in the future. So in New York, for example, where some of these busing protests start, you have rumors that they're going to be busing millions of kids all across the city, right? So from different boroughs, from Staten Island up to Manhattan and Harlem and vice versa. None of that was actually on the table. But these are the kind of rumors that start to circulate in local community meetings and church meetings, and then eventually they get replayed in newspapers, in some cases on television. And so you have people protesting against what they fear might happen as opposed to the very small-scale type of integration proposals that were actually going to be implemented. So whereas a lot of the proposals were to send a few hundred students between schools that were only a few blocks apart, parents are often reacting against plans that they think is eventually going to send thousands and thousands of students miles and miles away. It was very difficult for civil rights activists and proponents of school segregation to fight against those myths because they had such power, because they were based on people's fears about things that might happen in the future. It was very difficult. It was not rational in many ways. It was people arguing and lobbying the worst possible case scenarios that were very unlikely to actually take place.
That's the voice of Matthew Delmont. He is the author of Why Busing Failed, Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. And you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. So one of the points that you make in your book, Why Busing Failed, is that focusing just on the white resistance, the white families, is only part of the story. And part of the problem with histories and the way busing is remembered is it just focuses on that. However, it obviously is part of the story. And so I want to ask you a bit about who was involved in opposing busing, i.e. school desegregation in the North, and framed it around this question of busing. Was this a spontaneous movement of families? Was it more coordinated? How do we understand the origins of that resistance?
So origins of the resistance were, it involved a lot of parents, particularly white mothers, who were concerned about their schools. And I think that's why it resonated so powerfully in the national media. The cases they were making sounded great, that they were lobbying for neighborhood schools, they're lobbying for their rights as parents and as mothers to have a voice in where their children were going to be sent to school. They often grew out of existing relationships, whether those relationships were through parent-teacher associations, or through churches, or through community organizations. But then they started to sort of stitch themselves together on regional and national levels. And the media actually helped them do this, right? So you had activists in different communities. They could see how people were lobbying against busing in places like New York or places like Chicago. And then when issues would come to their city, they would often pick up much of the same language. So even if they hadn't met these other protesting parents in person, they could see that they were not alone in being concerned or being fearful about what school segregation might mean for their communities. By and large, most of these parents were in neighborhoods that voted Democratic. Most of them probably would have identified as liberal. Almost all of them would have said they're not racist and that they had good relationships with African-Americans and with Puerto Ricans in the Northeast. But what they had was they had the ability and the power to have politicians listen to them when they wanted to protect their schools. So in contrast to African-American parents who were sending their kids to schools that were often underfunded, under-resourced, had fewer experienced teachers, everyone wanted to advocate for their children, right? So you had activist mothers on both sides. The African-American activist mothers didn't have politicians listen to them in the same way that you had the white activist mothers listen to them. I think that's one of the things that it's hard to remember when you see some of this old footage, that a lot of the things that the white mothers are saying, they intuitively make a lot of sense, that of course they want their children to go to the best schools, and of course they want what's best and most convenient for their children, but African-American parents were saying a lot of the same things, and they just weren't being listened to.
So one part of the story, which we'll get into as we go on, is how the media took up the cause of these white parents, and the story was very much framed around them. To what degree, though, were these white parents, especially white mothers, a very media-friendly image, including the one on the cover of your book, Why Busing Failed, which has a mother holding a little child standing in front of a school bus blocking it. But to what degree was this movement a mass movement?
So it's a funny question, because in some ways it was a mass movement in terms of the amount of attention received. In other ways, it was not a mass movement at all because there weren't that many people involved in it. So starting with the first side is the parents who were pushing against busing and the politicians who were pushing against it often described it as massive busing. This is particularly a catchphrase that came out in the 1970s. What I was interested to find when I actually started doing the research is even at its peak, court-ordered busing only applied to just about 5% of school children in the 1970s. So we had this perception that kids were being bused all over the country in the 1970s to desegregate schools, and it's just not true. That there were a handful of corridors in a handful of cities, and those garnered a tremendous amount of media attention. So it was a mass movement in the sense that it received a mass amount of attention. But in terms of who was actually participating, there weren't thousands and thousands and thousands of parents who were actively mobilized to resist busing. But there were key segments of parents in a lot of key cities that were dedicated to the issue, and they were successful in getting people to pay attention to them. So I think one of the best cases is a woman named Irene McCabe, who is from Pontiac, Michigan. She led this somewhat amazing, what's called a mother's march. It was her and five other mothers who marched from Pontiac, Michigan to Washington, D.C., 620 miles, as a way to lobby for a constitutional amendment against busing. She received national news coverage on both television and newspapers for this six-week march that she was doing. So millions and millions of people would have heard about her story. When she actually arrived in Washington, D.C., only about 1,000 people actually showed up to support her rally. So there's a disconnect between how much attention the media paid to these anti-busing protesters and how many anti-busing protesters they were. And I think, unfortunately, for the cause of school desegregation, the few thousand very, very vocal anti-busing protesters came to dominate the national conversation, eventually came to really thwart school desegregation nationally.
Well, this may be a hard question to answer, but in your research of busing, the controversy around it, the mobilizations, and the media coverage, if one can sift out this question from how the media shaped the whole story, do you think that these white families, people like Irene McCabe, were representative of the majority sentiment of, say, working-class white parents living in cities, or is that just something that we can't really figure out in hindsight?
I couldn't give you a precise percentage, but I think it is fair to say that they were representative, and I feel comfortable saying that for two reasons. One is that they received thousands of letters from parents all across the country. Right? This is both true of the grassroots activists and the politicians who raised their voices against busing. So we have some sense that even the parents who President Nixon might have called the silent majority, even if they weren't out there marching in the street, they supported the political sentiments that were being advocated by some of the more vocal anti-busing activists. And then secondly, there was not a groundswell of support in favor of school desegregation in the North among white parents. And so I think that's, if there were people who were vehemently opposed to some of the anti-busing activists among white communities, they didn't show up. I think that's one of the challenges for thinking about school desegregation in these northern, midwestern, and western cities, is that by and large, the parents who didn't raise their voice in either direction, their perspectives tended to get grouped with the people who were advocating against school desegregation, because the default case was if schools were not going to be forcibly desegregated through court orders, they were going to be segregated schools. Right? These are segregated schools often in the suburbs and in many cities. If white parents didn't advocate for an opposite direction, for actually desegregating schools, then they were going to end up having segregated schools. If they didn't lobby against that, then unfortunately they were siding with the people who were opposing busing.
Indeed. What about opposition to desegregating schools and the whole controversy around busing as a stand-in for that by mainstream politicians, Republican and Democrat, on a national scale?
So busing is really one of the few bipartisan issues you find in the 1960s and 70s. So one of the most important things that I found when I was working on this book is the way in which when the Civil Rights Act is written in 1964, it's written with explicit anti-busing provisions that are included in it. And those are included at the behest of Northern, primarily Democratic and liberal senators, because they're reflecting their constituents' fears about school desegregation. So they define desegregation, what the Civil Rights Act is going to be able to achieve, as being it's going to fight against desegregation as it looks in the South, but it's not going to fight against what they called racial imbalance in the North. That's really important because it limits what the federal government can do in terms of uprooting segregation. So it gave the federal government power to go into the South and say, you can't have segregated schools anymore, but at the same time, it directed the attention of federal authorities away from schools in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. So it's one way in which politicians, in this case from the Democratic Party, did a lot to maintain segregated schools, and it's not something that we usually call attention to. After the Civil Rights Act in 1964, you have politicians from both parties taking up busing as an issue that they're going to run with. I think one of the reasons you see so much of that is there's very little downside for them to advocate against busing, because there isn't, beyond civil rights activists and beyond the African American community, there isn't a strong pro-busing camp. So there's a one-term governor from Florida named Claude Kirk, who took over the school district in Manatee, Florida, for a period of time and had, again, a period of where he received a tremendous amount of national media attention for his resistance to busing. President Nixon plays the most important role, both in terms of speaking against busing with his national platform, but then also appointing judges who are going to advocate for those kind of policies. But you also see Democratic politicians either advocating explicitly against busing or not taking a stand one way or the other on the issue.
Well, let's talk about a movement on the other side, which is that of the civil rights movement in the North. And the people who, and you've alluded to this earlier in the program, the parents and other people who were involved in trying to dismantle school segregation. What did that movement look like?
So civil rights activism in the North was widespread and dedicated for decades. I think it's one thing that we lose when we just focus on Boston in the 1970s is that in Boston, in New York, in Chicago, all across the country, you have people who have been working on these issues of school segregation, of school equality for decades before the 1970s. In New York, Kenneth Clark, who's most famous from his Dowell test that got cited in the Brown versus Board decision, and Ella Baker, who's most famous for her grassroots organizing in the South, are two of the key activists who are fighting to organize parents to pressure the school board to do something about school segregation in New York. In Boston, there's a woman named Ruth Batson who organizes parents for decades before the 1970s. So it was really a widespread movement, and they were dedicated, resilient, and resourceful. They were fighting a very, very difficult fight to try to uproot school segregation in the North because the people they were fighting against denied the existence of school segregation. They said, you know, this can't be happening in the North. It can only happen in the South. And so civil rights activists had to keep parents engaged in this activism while also trying to change the terms of the debate and reframe the debate to say, you know, yes, this can be happening in the North, and then try to bring those cases to courts to actually get courts to find that school segregation was in place. Some of the most large-scale protests that take place are in the early 1960s. You have a series of organized school boycotts. New York is the largest, but it also happens in Chicago and in Boston. In the case of New York, over 460,000 students stay out of school in early 1964 to protest against these conditions of educational inequality. And that 460,000 number is important because it's actually the largest civil rights event of the decade, right? So it's much larger than the March on Washington. But it's something that most people aren't aware of. And I think one of the reasons people aren't aware of it is that the way in which it was covered by the media at the time, by the New York Times in this case, looked very different than how they chose to cover civil rights in the South. They described that boycott in New York as a case of illegal adult-encouraged truancy. And so it didn't have the same kind of moral backing as the civil rights movement did in the South. The last thing I'll say about the civil rights activism in the North is it ends up being largely unsuccessful on the school issue, unfortunately, that they push on these issues for years and years and years and only ever get small-scale victories. They, in some cases, they're able to force issues to court. They can win those court cases, but by then the school districts have delayed taking any efforts for so long that that there's been such white flight that schools can't be integrated in meaningful ways. And so by the late 1960s, you start to see a lot of these activists turn their attention more towards community control of schools, and they, in many cases, leave school segregation behind as a goal. But it shouldn't call our attention away from the fact that you had decades of activism pushing for educational equality in the North.
Matthew Delmont is my guest. We'll return with him in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by Associate Professor of History at Arizona State University, Matthew Delmont. We are talking about his book, Why Busing Failed, Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. That's published by the University of California Press. He's also the author of The Nicest Kids in Town, American Bandstand, Rock and Roll, and the Struggle for Civil Rights in 1960s Philadelphia. So when one thinks of busing, it's hard not to think of Boston, because that was certainly represented in the media as the flashpoint for what was framed as a crisis around busing in the 1970s. I wonder if you could tell us what Boston schools looked like at the point of court-ordered desegregation in Boston and the emergence of this hot-button issue around busing.
Sure. So by the 1970s, Boston schools have bifurcated along lines of race and class. So you have some schools that are relatively affluent and are getting a fair amount of resources, and you have a number of other schools that are not getting resources in anything like the same way. And those are primarily African-American schools. And I think the resources here are important. So the issues that civil rights activists were pushing against, it was not so much wanting to have black kids just sit next to white kids, but they saw when they would go into these white schools that the teachers were more experienced, there were fewer substitute teachers, that you had more funding per child, so there would be more current textbooks. You had fewer children in the schools. The school buildings themselves were newer at the white schools. And so these were the issues, these kind of resource-based issues that they were fighting for. Again, that is taking place at least two decades before this crisis develops in Boston. And you have civil rights activists bringing this issue consistently to the Boston School Committee, which was chaired at times by Louise Day Hicks, who becomes a kind of national figure of the white backlash. These civil rights activists are bringing this issue year after year, month after month, but they're consistently refused by Boston school officials, by Boston politicians. And that's the story people usually forget when they start the story of Boston in the 1970s, that the crisis in Boston wasn't just about busing, it was about unconstitutional segregation, that the busing order was put in place because Judge Arthur Garrity found that Boston schools had been intentionally segregated for decades. And that was what the busing order was meant to address. And that period, that intentional segregation, I think one of the concerns I have with how we usually talk about busing is we talk about the feelings and the anger of white communities, right? So the images of how angry South Boston was when busing happened are etched in our brains. But the story in Boston, all these other cities, was about the constitutional rights of black students, right? That's why these busing orders were put in place in the first place. And those busing orders were meant to try to level the playing field and try to get equal resources for African-American students, which they just weren't getting in Boston schools in the 1970s.
Well, following up with that thread, as you say, all of the focus around busing has to do with what has been framed as the white backlash and the narrative of the white backlash. What did busing represent for African-Americans in the North and Midwest and West?
So for African-American parents and civil rights activists, what they wanted was better educational opportunities for their students. That could look a number of different ways, and so different parents advocate for different things, but better educational opportunities meant that they would receive the same kind of school funding that white schools did, that their teachers would be qualified, that the schools would have the same, that their classes would have the same number of students, that the buildings would be modern, that the textbooks would be modern and not have racist imagery and racist stereotypes in them. These are the things that parents all across the country were advocating for. So it wasn't so much busing wasn't a panacea that they saw as a sort of perfect solution, but it was one tool among many that they thought could improve educational opportunities for their students. And again, it was about resources, not so much about just sitting next to white kids, but they recognized that in almost all of these cities, the resources were disproportionately going to white schools and going away from black schools. They thought, if we can integrate the schools meaningfully, if we can actually get the segregation here, then maybe our kids can go to schools to have these kind of resources. In cases where, so there are a couple avenues that end up pursuing. So one would be the courts. They bring those cases to court as a way to try to force schools, school boards to act. They try all manners of persuasion to get school officials to do something. In some cases, Berkeley and Minneapolis, for example, have somewhat successful voluntary programs of busing, but most school boards were unwilling to do anything unless they were ordered by the court. So the lawsuit route was one that was profitable for African-American parents to try to ensure these educational opportunities. The other are these kind of creative programs to independently get their children to better schools. So one of the most famous ones is called Operation Exodus, which took place in Boston, organized by African-American woman named Ellen Jackson and some other parents. And in this case, they used their own resources to rent school buses that would pick up students in African-American neighborhoods and then take them to suburban schools, primarily white schools, a few kids to each school, as a way to improve their educational outcomes. They took advantage of a program called open enrollment that put a huge onus on the parents, but these parents were desperate to do anything they could to improve educational opportunities for their own children. And I think it speaks to the resolve of Black parents to find educational opportunities for their students, even if it meant rearranging their work schedules, even meant dedicating resources beyond their tax dollars to transporting their own kids to these suburban schools. These parents were dedicated to doing whatever they could to improve educational opportunities for their students.
Well, let's talk a bit more about Boston, and bearing in mind what you said, which is the real crisis in Boston was, of course, the extent of school segregation, which gets lost in this picture. But the opponents of desegregating schools, the opponents of busing, framed the conflict at the time as one of crisis. And I wonder if you could talk a bit more about how that notion of crisis was used.
So I think a lot of what we understand about that idea of crisis with regards to busing has a lot to do with how it was covered by the television media. So it's not to say that busing was not violent in Boston. It, in some cases, was. It's not to say that it was not a very hot-button political issue. It certainly was. But the way in which once television stations decided to cover Boston, in some cases they never left. So what's interesting when you go back and watch the television footage from this era is you would have the stations, ABC, NBC, CBS, reporting when something violent happened, right? So when you had white protesters throwing bricks at school buses. But they were also reporting even when nothing happened. So if there was a quiet day at Boston schools, Walter Cronkite would come on the news and say, this was month two of the Boston busing crisis, and today it was quiet, right? And so it would be a recurring storyline, even when there was no new news to report from the situation. And I think that idea of crisis, it shifted the attention away from what was really at stake. So, again, the footage of this almost comes to look a lot like footage from the Vietnam War. So you have periods where they're just showing uninterrupted minute-long clips of the police or the National Guard coming in to try to break up white crowds of demonstrators, police riding on horseback, arresting people. And it's very easy to watch that footage and have no idea why these people are protesting in the first place. You entirely lose sight of the fact that this was about Black students and their constitutional rights. What you end up focusing on is the fact that, you know, this was a huge protest going on, and you had to bring in both state and national authorities, police, National Guard, to try to quell these protests. And I think that's when we think about the crisis shifts it into something that's more of a media construction than a legal issue or a moral issue about education.
Well, let's talk about the media then. So there's a perception that the U.S. media gave voice to the Southern Civil Rights Movement, bringing into American homes the terrible images of white Southerners and police attacking Black protesters. Number one, is that an accurate view of how the media did cover the Southern Civil Rights Movement? And if so, why does it differ so much from the coverage of school desegregation in the North?
Yeah, so the relationship between the national news media and the Southern Civil Rights Movement, absolutely. It played a critical role in bringing Southern Civil Rights to national audiences, in both TV producers, newspaper reporters, and civil rights activists themselves attest to that. So almost everyone agrees that it's one of the great victory stories for the U.S. news media, is the way in which they covered civil rights in the South and the way in which they really forced Americans to pay attention to what was going on in Alabama and Mississippi. So I think that's absolutely true. What you find when you shift your attention to the North is that the story looks very different, and it looks very different for two reasons. One, the mechanisms of racism and discrimination in the North were much more subtle than they were in the South. So you don't have the same kind of fire hoses, police dogs, police with billy clubs beating peaceful protesters in the North as you do in the South. That the mechanisms of discrimination in the North were often about where do you draw school zoning lines, who can get a mortgage loan in which neighborhood. Those things don't resonate visually in quite the same way. They don't get conveyed in the media in the same way, because these are aspects of discrimination that were taking place over decades, and they took a long time to form. And the media just doesn't pick up on them the same way. the second reason it's covered differently in the North is that most of the national news media is based in the North. So they're based in New York or in D.C. or in Chicago. And they're much more timid about covering issues in their own cities than they were in the South. I think this has to do with their lack of understanding of what civil rights or racism looked like in the North. So they just fundamentally couldn't believe that this could be a Northern issue, that it could only exist in Alabama, Mississippi, it couldn't exist in Massachusetts or New York. But then also they were worried about offending their viewers outside of the South. So it was in some ways easier to point to the South and say, this is the backwards region of the United States where racism still exists. It was much more difficult to look at Chicago or look at New York and say, these places that we consider liberal are actually deeply racist in how they're constructing their school policies or how they have their housing policies constructed. That's a difficult thing for the media to convey, and they were very timid in terms of how they presented this issue to their audiences.
In the ways that the media covered school desegregation in the North and the backlash against busing, was that something that was particularly specific to television, or would you say that that was really across the board, print media and so on?
So I think the big difference between the television and newspaper coverage in this area is television becomes the dominant national news form. I think that's important for two reasons. There's one, they're reaching national audiences, millions and millions of viewers, in a way that newspapers can't. And also, they don't have the same kind of local connections that newspapers do. So I think, to generalize, newspapers had the opportunity to provide better coverage of these issues because they had dedicated education reporters who were in cities, and they could follow the stories. They knew the people on the ground who were the key players in the stories. And they at least had the opportunity to provide more kind of fleshed out coverage of the issues. They also had more space to do so in terms of the length of their stories and how they could revisit a story. Television news was really – what's interesting about television news and how it covered the issue is that they had to make decisions about how they allocated their camera teams, right? And so one thing that hadn't really occurred to me until I got into this research is if they're going to cover a protest in Pontiac, they have to know in advance that protest is taking place. And so it's one of the things, and this is true of Boston as well, it's one of the reasons Boston gets so much coverage, is once a place gets identified as a site of conflict or a site where a story is going to develop, then the television camera crews can be dispatched in advance to those locations, and they can report on something, whether there's an interesting story coming from there or not. That has a lot to do – that ends up shaping how these issues get understood, right? If you're only – if television is interested in things that make for good visual stories, they're drawn to these large-scale mass protests against busing. But they want to know that if they're going to dedicate a camera crew to go there, that's going to be a good story to come of it. So once busing got established as a consistent storyline, it's almost like a perpetuating cycle, that once television got interested in busing, it got more interested in busing because they knew that this was something that they could send a camera team there, they could get good footage from Pontiac or from Chicago or Boston and make for a compelling story from it. What was difficult, though, is that television didn't have any local connections here. So you had – and they would have television reporters – interviews from them where they describe this kind of context. They describe it as you parachute into a city, try to quickly get up to speed on what's going on there, and then do a 2-minute or 3-minute segment on that story. These stories about school segregation were incredibly complex, and so part of it isn't about blaming television news. It's just a kind of a structural limitation of that media form, but they continued to report on these issues in a way that would be visually interesting to their audiences, and that meant that they were drawn to people who had very clear talking points and very clear sound bites, and those were the anti-busing activists. But it had a lot to do with – it ended up shaping how the conversation about school segregation developed, because the pro-busing side was more complex in terms of their sound bites. They couldn't speak quite the same way to the television media, but also they just weren't – they weren't visually attractive in the same way that the anti-busing forces were.
Historian Matthew Delmont is my guest. We're talking about his book, Why Busing Failed, Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation, published by UC Press. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. One of the interesting things, though, in thinking about how media coverage differed from the coverage of the Southern Civil Rights Movement and then the Civil Rights Movement in the North, is that one thing that shifted was that the anti-busing protesters harnessed some of the rhetoric that the Southern Civil Rights Movement had used and used it against the Northern Civil Rights Movement.
Absolutely. So the people who end up being opposed to school segregation, these anti-busing activists in the North, were very careful students of the civil rights movement. So they watched people like Martin Luther King lead these marches, and they purposely constructed their marches and their talking points in a very similar way. So a couple things to highlight is the people who were advocating against school segregation in cities like New York or Pontiac, they would say, this is our civil rights movement. These are our civil rights, and we're fighting for them. They would never say, we don't want our children to be sent to school with black students, or we don't want black students to be sent to our neighborhood schools. They would say, these are our civil rights. These are our rights as parents, so taking up the exact same language that civil rights activists had used just a few years earlier. But then also they were very keenly aware of how to structure their protests. So they would have lots of protests with women and children foregrounded with American flags, with clearly marked signs, a lot of the same kind of techniques and tactics that the civil rights movement used, including protest marches that echoed back to key civil rights moments. So Irene McCabe, who I mentioned, led a mother's march to Washington, right? Again, a purposeful echo of the 1963 march in Washington, but for a very different purpose, right? She's trying to lobby for a constitutional amendment to block busing, but she takes on the language of the mother who's doing this on behalf of her children's rights, and is going on this sort of brave sacrificial journey to fight for her rights as an American citizen.
You've been describing in this hour how you had valiant African-American parents trying to desegregate the schools of the North. You had this pushback by white parents who were backed by national politicians and backed by the media. And in the telling of the histories of the civil rights movement, we are told this is the end. This was the end of the civil rights movement. It ran up against busing in the North. I wonder if you could tell us your assessment of what busing represented in that larger picture and the fate of this question of school segregation.
I think in our larger understanding of civil rights, I think busing is useful in a couple of ways. The first is we still have a perception that civil rights moved north in some way, that it wasn't until Martin Luther King started coming to Chicago in the mid-60s that the civil rights movement moved north, and that's definitely not true. You had dedicated civil rights activists, a fully formed civil rights movement in the North, in the Midwest, in the West, before Martin Luther King or Southern activists came there. But at the same time, you had dedicated resistance to civil rights also in the North, long before Martin Luther King got there. And I think if we think about civil rights in a national context, we can appreciate the fact that this was both a national movement for African-American civil rights, but also that there was resistance at a national level, right? So we, as a nation, I think we like to look to the Southern movement and find all the things that are good about our country or sort of good about our better nature. But when you look to cities like Boston, Chicago, and New York, and the way in which white parents and politicians resisted issues like school segregation or housing integration, you can see that support for civil rights was thin, right? The support that the nation gave, particularly white citizens gave to civil rights, was okay if it was taking place in the South, but it was not okay if it was taking place in their own city or in their own neighborhood. Right? I think busing helped to expose that the limitation of support for civil rights, that support for civil rights was never as widespread as we would like to believe among white citizens, that it was something that there was a lot of support for when it was in the South, in Mississippi, Alabama, a lot less support for when it was coming to California or Massachusetts.
Sure. And then what happened with the cause of school desegregation from the mid-70s onward?
So it continues. After Boston in 1974, you have a number of school districts who are brought into court, and the courts find that the schools have intentionally segregated their school systems against the Constitution, against the 14th Amendment. And you have court-ordered busing put in place in a number of schools all across the country. And these take place with less fanfare. In some cities, they work better than in other cities. But you have parents never stop fighting to get better educational opportunities for their students. So busing, in some ways, has more periods of success in the late 1970s and 1980s, once it can take place more at a local level outside of the national media's attention. But there's, at the same time, you have more parents with means moving to suburbs and dedicating their resources to building schools that are largely segregated in the suburbs, and that's where their resources are going to be. So you have a bifurcation of city school districts and suburban school districts. And it, after the Supreme Court's Milliken decision in Detroit in 1974, it becomes impossible to have school segregation plans that cross over between city and suburban school districts. And that really limits the potential for closing this resource gap.
So then, if you were to do an assessment now of the degree to which American schools, especially in the areas that we've been talking about in the North, in the Midwest, the West, are still segregated, how would you assess that?
Well, the demographic reports that come out, and UCLA's Center for Civil Rights does a report annually about the level of national school segregation, and they consistently find that a lot of these large northern school districts are as segregated, or in some cases more segregated, than they were in the 1960s. And this is disheartening for people who care about these issues, but I think a lesson we can learn from the history is trying to understand why school segregation, why court orders didn't lead to more full school segregation in the 1960s and 70s. And I think if we can understand the kind of resistance that they faced and the kind of limitations that were placed by politicians in the Civil Rights Act and the legislation about what was even possible, when we look at the contemporary landscape, my hope is that we can better understand what tactics might work now to improve both racial and socioeconomic integration of schools. And then where that kind of integration is impossible, lobby for the kind of resource reallocation that would bring more qualified teachers, more textbooks, more smaller class sizes to schools where they're most needed.
Well, I do, of course, realize you're a historian, but I wonder if you could expand a bit on those lessons that could be drawn from the past. What do you think, or what is indicated to you about what avenues might work to desegregate schools and which ones might be trickier?
Yeah, I think a lesson we can learn from the history is that parents and school officials who care about these issues have to fight for them. I think that's something that's clear from looking at the history, that it was too easy for people who were on the fence to not take a position on either side. But what we need is if people care about school integration, whether it's by race or by socioeconomic class, you have to voice those opinions and stick to those commitments. We're in a trickier place now after the Supreme Court's Parents' Choice decision in Seattle in the late 2000s really limited what can be done in terms of race. So I think there's probably more pragmatic avenues to take right now in terms of integration based on class or integration based on socioeconomic status. But I think for those to be successful, I think I have to confront people's parents' fears and concerns about what those kind of decisions might mean for their children. Right? I think that's one thing that people didn't do enough of the first time around. It was too easy for parents' fears to dominate the conversation in a negative way. But if we recognize that changing the status quo, recognizing two things, one, that the status quo of education is not going to work for our civic life and for our country going forward. But to change that, that's going to be scary to a lot of people, and particularly it's going to be scary to a lot of people who like their educational opportunities now. I think trying to address those issues head on and recognize that a case has to be made why there's a moral case and a civic case for educational equality and how decisions can be made to produce better outcomes. That has to be almost like a public relations campaign. That has to be repeatedly stated and repeatedly advocated for on a consistent basis by people who have the authority and the power to advocate for it. And I think that's important because the system we have right now didn't come up naturally. Right? I think that's one of the limitations we have when we think about this idea of de facto segregation, that nothing about the segregation we have in the present moment is natural. It was a series of decisions that took place all across the country by parents, by politicians, for years and years and years. To undo that, we have to make a different set of decisions. And I think we need a commitment and a vocal commitment to take our educational system with regards to school segregation in a different direction.
Well, given that so many Americans live in neighborhoods that are still racially segregated, do you think that in addressing school segregation, that having buses which will allow children to get to schools that are not in their neighborhoods, whether it's based on class or, you know, some other rubric, that is a necessary part of addressing school segregation now?
I think so. I think this will look different in different cities. I mean, in some cases, you can redraw zoning lines in a way that will produce different kind of school demographics. In some cases, there would be transportation involved, whether it's by public transportation or by school buses. But I think doing something is essential, and recognizing the way in which previous attempts to address these issues were undercut before they were even given a real chance is crucial to charting a better future with this.
Matthew Delmont, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
I've been speaking with the author of Why Busing Failed, Race, Media, and the National Resistance to School Desegregation. That's published by the University of California Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Matthew Delmont teaches history at Arizona State University and is also the author of The Nicest Kids in Town, American Bandstand, Rock and Roll, and the Struggle for Civil Rights in 1960s Philadelphia. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.